I got the food sent to. Honorable members, even those who are not around because of other committees, but particularly oversight visit, let me welcome you. Let me welcome the Department of Energy. Let me welcome the Coast Estate, ESCOM. I just happened to speak to someone from NGEN. I don't know who else is around from other places, but let me welcome them as well. And unfortunately, I hope you're not like me. I was so late to come. I think I still have a holiday, Baba Laugh. Yeah. Although we've had 3 weeks of constituency work, went over various schools to check their readiness. Well, he had cause to smile, he had cause not to smile, but you are here now. Let me welcome everybody back in this hectic 2013, very, very hectic, the last full year before we have a sprint in 2014 towards the national election. And for those of you who have been around, you know, those few months next year. And please, department, don't bring deals in 2014, because we know what's going to happen. It's a very pressurizing period. However, honorable members, let me say, welcoming you back, let's just reflect. We've had a very, very hectic year last year. We've done our bit on various things. We've done oversight work. We've done public participation. We opened the year by going to Durban to check refineries. We've had a series of energy stakeholders meeting, a new practice that we've introduced. We still have to ensure that we come up with recommendations to the department on out of all those stakeholders meetings, which were very eye-opening, the input that were made there. We've done our few oversight visits, and we closed the year once again with those oversight visits in Tswane and Johannesburg, and how we should have had even more time. We've tried our best to have a little bit of internal empowerment. Unfortunately, things didn't work as we would have loved to, because we don't have to take for granted that when we get and engage both with the department, other departments, state agencies, and the public at large, that we are equal to their knowledge and fully equipped. So empowerment and ongoing empowerment as members of parliament is important. I trust you will agree that even this year we'll do our best to ensure that for all intricate and complex issues that we'll be handling, we do the same until the close of the year. 2013 is a year where we have we've just started 2013 as this two-year cycle for us to get international trips. But I would like to suggest that we don't just talk about international trips. We talk about international programs. Because international work doesn't mean, is not necessarily equal to international trips. You can have people in visiting us. You know, that's international work. So if we could just do that paradigm shift and really get robust on international work, climate change issues are an eye-opener on that, and also issues such as shale gas itself, generally. I mean, everything, in any case. And in that respect, I hope also the department will ensure that they share with us with speed all international agreements that they need to present to us, because as a matter of practice, international agreements, the bulk of them have got to go through Parliament, either for ratification or for, depending on the nature, at times for just for information. That's sort of the experience I had in trade and industry. There were different types of agreements, Honourable Member. Some were just to be submitted. That, look, this is what we've done. It's sort of within the ambit of the department to conclude this agreement. But some of them, as a practice, the executive has got to bring them. Unfortunately, we haven't had the opportunity, the luxury of getting exposed to any of those agreements. So, given that you would like to be rather robust on international work this year, surely if you could convey that to the powers that be, that we really would like to do that. Mama Marabwa, when she came last year and briefed us, we did highlight that, but we're just reinforcing it once again. It's going to be quite an exciting area. We definitely, this quarter, are going to have bulk of our time on the Eastmore Bill. I trust and hope and pray once we get the report from the task team of further due diligence around the transmission sector, once we conclude that, we will lend whilst running to grapple and handle the Eastmore Bill. Now that we have the financial closures to the tune of 49 billion, it therefore means that also we have an equal duty, Honourable Members, as on behalf of Parliament, to ensure that we facilitate that environment and have the requisite tools, and amongst them the Eastmore Act, as it will be at the end of the day, you know, sorted out in future. And I insist on that, because it's not just we process the Act, I mean the bill at Parliament level. Beyond that, it still has to go through the presidency for whatever term they use, so that takes time, and we wouldn't like to have any of the service providers on renewable energy think that they are hamstrung because of the Act. We know some of the implications, I mean positive implications and significance of the Eastmore Act, as well as the institutionalization thereof, that comes with it. Having said that, today we're going to handle what we call iskoloto on Skelt Beachy. The first thing that we're going to handle today is the free basic alternative energy. If you remember last year, we did invite a couple of groups, agencies, the department and other institutions to share with us on free basic electricity and free basic alternative energy. But if you remember, Honourable Members, everybody came with information on free basic electricity only. But unfortunately, we picked that up, that the second leg was not addressed, so that's why we're addressing it. It's very fundamental, it's very, very important, because this is about addressing the needs of the poor, the indigent, and particularly where there is no electricity, number one. But number two, given that not just in South Africa, the world over, there's a strong drive to search for alternatives, forms of and sources of energy. So we don't have to be left behind if also those alternative sources of energy are to be suitable for the poor. But then it will have to be up to scratch and be abreast with policy development and driving the programs, even in South Africa, around the free basic alternative energy. The other area is the biofuel strategy. For some time, we've been waiting for the department to share with us the refined strategy. And it took time, unfortunately, but at the end of the day, the latest strategy went through the cabinet, and if I get it correctly, it's for public comments now. So we also would like to have a bite and be exposed to the biofuel strategy. In fact, recently I saw an article whereby there were very interesting comments by the United Nations agencies dealing with food around biofuels, and also I think some multinational companies. So probably it's some good timing for us to address this. I must say the nature of the import today is about briefing, but obviously it's also a launching pad for us to engage on these issues quite intensively, even in future, given their significance. On one side, the free basic alternative energy for the indigent in particular and poor generally, and given the biofuels in terms of addressing the energy challenges that we have in South Africa. Obviously, I won't talk as long like this in future. I was just welcoming people, making sure that we recondition ourselves for the hectic and intensive year of 2013. It is going to be an intensive year, not only for us, but I suppose for Parliament. But obviously, we'll concentrate and focus on our sector, that is energy. I don't need to tell you much about what's happening out there. Today is the last week of NERSA's public consultation sessions, and you have seen how hectic and interesting that exercise is. And of course, by the way, we will be inviting NERSA as soon as they do the adjudication to come to share with us. You know, as soon as they make it public, they can come. They must tell us, you know, what do they decide on what are the reasons and all of us. But obviously, it's just that there'll have to be a proper timing on that. Before I hand over to the department, can the committee secretary just give us apologies?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just the following apologies. Honorable Selau and Honorable Matibela is unable to attend the meeting. Honorable Tinto is with the Portfolio Committee on Mineral Resources on an oversight visit. Honorable Mayatula and Honorable Khadebe is on oversight visit with the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training. And then I also received an apology from Honorable Ferguson, who fell sick this morning, Chair, but she's going to try and attend the meeting this morning. Those are the apologies, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope Ferguson gets well pretty soon. We need to hear. Mother, anyway. Can I then, shall I hand over to the department? Let me welcome you once again. If you could take us through the free basic alternative energy. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, Member of SOEs here, or everybody in the House, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is Matthew Banzijang from the Department of Energy, responsible for policy and regulations. I will be presenting on free basic alternative energy, but just to say that we have included some of the issues that touches to free basic alternative energy and free basic electricity, because they were intertwined. To a certain extent, as the Chairperson has explained, the free basic alternative energy is mainly to supplement or to complement energy, but I'll explain that in the presentation. Just to say that I'll touch on the background and the mandates, funding, implementation challenges, and possible interventions, status, and then conclude. Just to say that if you recall, well, the mandate initially came when the government announced it in 2000, almost 13 years ago, during the President Mbeki's time. And since then, we started with free basic electricity. I think we launched it in 2003. And after that, that's where we found the loophole that we needed to supplement free basic electricity because we're still battling with the universal access and the household and that also need energy, which then alternative energy was a policy approach on that regard. The main aim of the free basic energy or free basic electricity policy intervention was to provide basic energy to the poor household to limit poverty. Minimizing the health impact because it's one of the serious issue in terms of use of energy, making sure that we use the cleaner energy or cleaner fuel. And unfortunately, the FBE or the free basic electricity was only the provision for both grid and non-grid. So the FBE was supposed to supplement those houses or focus on mainly on the houses that doesn't have electricity because they don't qualify for free basic electricity. And that's where then we acknowledge that the poor households in South Africa process of electricity to cover remaining households in terms of free basic alternative energy. As I've explained, that the FBE was intended to households that are unelectrified because of lack of infrastructure, and we then develop guidelines for a policy on that regard, which was then ultimately published and given to municipalities and Department of Local Government, COPTA then, to implement. I'll explain in terms of legislative mandate how the implementation was done. And the provision of alternative energy carriers was more expensive to the grid on that regard. So some of the municipalities also, there's an issue of affordability because when you look at the electricity, maybe 50 kilowatt hour that is given to people with household with electricity, it's equivalent to 30-35 rand. Comparatively to the amount that we have we're proposing on the policy, which I'll touch base on. And the other thing is that with the alternative energy sources, they are a bit expensive and they are not regulated. So it was a bit of a challenge on that regard, comparatively to FBE. And just to touch base a bit on some of the interventions, mainly in line with our objective of protecting the poor and making sure they afford the energy. Well, in electricity, we do have IBTs, which is one of the interventions that we do. The more you use, the more you pay. And some of the municipalities are already implementing it, but the poor people are also profiting, or they are also enjoying the benefits. And also, to a certain extent, we facilitate in the FBE and also the subsidy on electrification. The other thing is the connections, and mainly on Eskom low consumption residential customers. Lower prices increase apply to lower consumption domestic customers. So we are actually trying to protect the low consuming customers, which are the poor customers. Just to say that in terms of the mandate, how do we then work in terms of provision of FBE? I think the point of the patient should know that the households fall within the jurisdictions of municipalities. So on that regard, all the municipal laws apply to implementation of service at the municipal level, from the constitution to all the legislations that are there. So in line with the department, they have to follow the tune. And our policies in terms of implementation of free basic energy and free basic electricity, they are following the legislation from the Constitution downwards. So on that regard, as you know, that the Constitution provides a provision of legislation with regard to the matter responsibly necessary for and accidentally to the effective exercise of power concerning the matter listed in Schedule 4 of the Constitution. And also the section 139 of the constitution that provides for provincial intervention when municipality doesn't fulfill its duty. So our main mandate comes from the constitution, and there's a lot of other legislations, including municipality legislation, that goes to those issues. I won't go deeper into that because it's mainly in terms of understanding. But the bottom line in terms of 156, municipalities have executive authority in terms of energy at the their jurisdiction at the household level. So on that regard, municipalities are purely mandated to implement free basic electricity to the poor people and free basic alternative energy. So understanding that, that in terms of implementation of free basic alternative energy, the municipalities were the main authority in terms of implementing that. So the policy is also designed in that. And then it goes also to say that to a certain extent, municipalities were supposed to have relationships with service providers to provide the free basic alternative energy and implement it. And also the way when we agree with National Treasury in terms of equitable share allocation for FVE, we then it was then implemented in a sense that municipality will ultimately be given the money under equitable share allocation on that S grant CAF. So the municipalities do have money for free basic alternative energy, even though it's a question of whether is it sufficient or is it disadvantaging other municipalities that are poor. And also the municipalities, to a certain extent, the municipal health service also influence the support of certain fuel through FES. As I said, that we need a cleaner energy and also the environmental issues. So on that regard, it was not just ending. The municipality, to a certain extent, had the right to finance or to supplement the funding that they get from the S grant in terms of from National Treasury in terms of the FBAE if they needed to implement it. So this debt in terms of the funding and how is it being implemented. Let me just touch base on some of the issues that are mainly in line with the FEA. I already mentioned the mitigation in terms of the cost. And, well, from free basic electricity perspective, it's 50 kilowatt hour, and which I said is around 35 rand. And when we are doing a pilot study, I think in early 2003 to 2005, we discovered that from a poor perspective, from a poor person in South Africa, up to 60 kilowatt can be per month can be given to a poor household, which is equivalent to around 35 rand at the present cost. But then, to a certain extent, it's a matter of affordability, and some of the municipalities they even decide to give more in that regard. But you should bear in mind one thing: the free basic electricity in terms of that was including lighting, media access, limited heating and assisting the poor in terms of that. But when it comes to free basic alternative energy, I'll then explain the difference between the two. And also then it goes to the cost. Just to say that the policy then, after also a study, we discovered that an average cost for a poor household in terms of energy by then, which was a bit like more years ago, it was 48 rand, whether it's paraffin, as I mentioned, which are the products that we identified as alternative energy, whether it's LPG, whether it's candle, or whether it's firewood or coal, and biogas. But to a certain extent, we didn't close the free basic alternative energy to this six alternative energies, because there are new ones that are coming, and it's also geographical, because if you go to Witbank, you'll find there's more coal. If you go to, so it depends on the area to a certain extent, but the Department of always there to assist those municipalities that are interested in terms of implementing alternative energies. So on that regard, the free basic alternative energy done a research around it, but on top of that, there's an issue of cleaner usage of this paraffin. Like in terms of the proposed, we don't just advise the municipality to make an agreement with any other stakeholders. There should be a lot of other issues that are included. That include paraffins, those that are more safer, and also then it goes to a paraffin and delivery that is more convenient and so forth. The LPG, the candles and so forth, firewood, and also the coal, and the better usage of other instruments. But there's also another challenge in terms of this, because comparatively to electricity, which is in terms of capital funding and infrastructure funding is funded by electrification, the issue around FVAE was the issue of funding the capital cost of instruments or equipment that are used to for free-based alternative energy. Like paraffin, we need a paraffin stove. And for sure, the municipality can not just start providing paraffin without knowing that a poor household doesn't have a paraffin stove. LPG bottles, and you see those for a poor household, they cannot afford. So to a certain extent, starting the project needs to consideration of those issues and interventions in terms of finding all those alternative, instruments used for alternative energy. I just want to touch base on the FVAE, on the challenges around free basic electricity, free basic energy. You see the two challenges are intertwined. The poorest of the poor have a challenge in terms of when they get cut off because they didn't pay. In terms of that regard, they ultimately then say that those people, they don't have basic energy at all, and constitutionally it's wrong. So to a certain extent, legally they might be qualifying for free basic alternative energy if they don't have electricity, just to give them a basic energy to a certain extent. So there's that issue of disconnections, which it then which is a challenge to municipalities in terms of providing poor with the basic energy. The free basic electricity does not accumulate. That's how the system works. Your electricity is off because of non-payment. You don't have to go back and say my electricity was cut was off for the past 2 years, so I need to claim my past FVAE. And then you then have to say that as soon as you start connected, then you start benefiting from the saving. So it's a bit of a challenge also to say that you then disadvantage a customer to a certain extent. Because ESCOM, when they claim from municipality or whoever is a service provider, they claim according to the service that they have provided. They cannot say then for the past 15 years they didn't provide free basic electricity to a person because there was disconnection, so they cannot claim from municipality. I've already touched base on the issue of limited funding, which is a critical challenge around FBA implementation. The free basic electricity, free basic energy is a serious challenge when it comes to implementation of free basic alternative energy and electricity at provincial, district, and municipality. The reason being, according to the calculations that were done by National Treasury, is that within the S grant, within the money that goes to the municipality every year, the money includes the money for FVAE, and FVAE depending on the number of households that have electricity and the number of households that doesn't have electricity. But to a certain extent, as you know, that it's always a challenge that municipalities use money for their priorities, so they don't prioritize FVAE, which is a challenge why FVAE is badly implemented at some municipalities. And this is a serious challenge to say then how do you then intervene in terms of funding, because the more funding the municipality gets, the more they prioritize other issues than free basic alternative energy or free basic energy to a certain extent. So it's that challenge that you have in terms of it. There's also an issue of lack of capacity. The Department of Energy, COPTA, SALGA, and other municipalities, we do support municipalities, whoever, and from district level to municipal level in terms of, and we do have provincial committees also to try and assist. But unfortunately, to a certain extent, most municipalities have a challenge in regard to capacity of how to implement, how to have contracts. But some of those institutions that I mentioned are always there to assist if the municipality is willing to implement. The other challenge is that the issue of indigenous policy, if you recall well, the issue of indigenous policy is an issue of municipalities. On that regard, we had a long development of those policies, whether it should be a national policy on indigenous. But to a certain extent, if you recall well, the State of South Africa do have figures in terms of how many people are indigenous in South Africa and per municipalities. But the challenge around it is the definition depends on how much you get, which is the definition that South Africa used. But municipalities, to a certain extent, they have their own indigenous policy. They have their own way of defining municipalities. And also from the electricity perspective, there's a quicker way that we also have proposed in terms of municipalities which don't have policies to say that to a certain extent they can check on in terms of the consumption to a certain extent. So the issue of identifying who is supposed to get free basic alternative energy is a challenge. And even after all, as you know that you always say that even that policy and that indigenous register need to be verified as the first part, and the second part is that it need to be updated frequently. And updating it frequently then means that there's the money involved, there's a lot of other work that is required. And then it becomes a serious problem to most of the municipality to say that municipalities cannot do that to a certain extent. So you'll find that most of these indigenous registers are not updated. Some of the people already are working, they have enough money, they still qualify. So it's that challenge that you have. The other problem is an issue of token collection and enhancement of provision of FBS levels. The issue of token collection is bigger than the Department of Energy to a certain extent, because firstly, the municipality make a contract with whoever is a service provider. But to a certain extent, a service provider to provide a tax and collection office, there's a cost that is involved. And usually this is meant for rural areas. And to a certain extent, it depends on the number of households that are there for the office to be productive and pay itself in terms of the money required for that office. So we battle to have more offices or to have more collecting stations, or ultimately also to deliver or to deliver those tokens to the household. We're hoping that the new technology will assist us as we move towards a new technology of smart metering and so forth. But unfortunately, with the old technology of even of meters, of a normal meter, it's a bit a challenge just to go and collect the meters, because, I mean, the either the tokens to collect paraffin or something, because sometimes you even find that to travel to go to town is a bit expensive, more than the free basic alternative energy tokens. So that is also a challenge. And we have been trying to talk to different municipalities to assist in a certain way. And that's a challenge that you have. And MUNIX also is assisting beneficiaries on token collection and also advance on enhancement, as I've said. The issue of lack of communication. Since we started free basic alternative energy and free basic electricity for the past almost five to ten years, the issue of communication has been ongoing from different stakeholders, but even though it's limited because of depending on period of communication on that. So there's also an issue of lack of communication, but different institutions, including municipalities and DOE, are doing their part to do a bit of communication on free basic electricity, free basic energy. The other issue is lack of reporting and monitoring of evaluation in terms of the whole free basic alternative energy and free basic energy. And I want to spend a minute on this. If you recall well from my previous slide of saying the mandates in terms of the different institutions, to a certain extent, the Department of Energy have limited powers in terms of instructing municipality to give us figures in terms of it. So we, at DOE, we mainly depend on service providers in terms of our relationship that we have. In terms of COCTA, in terms of DORA, because the money comes from National Treasury via DORA to municipalities, they can be able to request legally request the money from the report from municipalities. So on that regard, the COCTA, in terms of the previous agreement, it was assigned to assist in terms of monitoring and evaluation of the free basic alternative energy. But unfortunately, in the past 2 years, there was a structure change at the COCTA, and the officials that were working mainly on reporting on FBAE, on FBE, were then deployed somewhere. But we have then went back to them, and they are restructuring to make sure that they take those responsibilities back where they belong, and then they will then start reporting back on free basic alternative energy and free basic energy. So on that regard, the figures that I might show you in terms of the status, they might be a bit old in that regard, but to a certain extent, the figures have not changed a lot. It's only that we cannot verify the one because we don't have true figures from the monetary institution, which is the COCTA. I just wanted to touch base also on in terms of the alternative energy, as I've said, how the funding works. The funding comes from National Treasury. I already explained this, and then it goes to COCTA, which then they include them on the F grant and then distribute them to municipalities. So that's basically how the money is. It's in line with all the most of the money that goes to municipalities. There's a soft, it's not the money that says thou shalt, because then you cannot instruct municipalities. So that's why municipality decides to do it, to use it for other things. It's a soft condition to say that in terms of our the national budget, this money was budgeted for free basic energy, free basic alternative energy. Then the municipality will then have to implement, but unfortunately most of the time they shift it to other responsibilities. And just to say that in terms of the benefits and such grant must be targeted to the poor household and in respect to FBAE. But unfortunately, most of the time, it's not been there. And just last one point, municipality must further allocate funds from the budget of AVA to supplement allocation to cover all the indigenous households. To a certain extent, some municipalities do allocate additional funding, even in terms of AVAE, to make sure that they implement AVAE, even beyond the expectation. But unfortunately, other municipalities, majority of municipalities, they're not doing it all. But still, municipalities have that right to supplement the allocation. As I said, I'll give you just a typical example of last year, January, that it was verified to say that. I'll just go to the last column, which says that around the people who were qualifying for free basic energy, it was around 72%. But most of the challenge is that this is mainly in terms of free basic electricity. When it comes to our test based on free basic alternative energy on the next slide, the challenge around there is because even some of the municipalities that have implemented free basic alternative energy, they don't report back, and they don't have the good figures in terms of credential figures that you can use for free basic alternative energy. But in general, the free basic alternative energy at the present status is between 72% and 75% of the qualifying customers. And I won't go deeper into this because it's mainly on free basic electricity. I was just giving you a snapshot today then. And then just comparing the different provinces to say that there are provinces that you have identified as very poor, and unfortunately they don't implement free basic electricity. That includes Eastern Cape, KZN, and Limpopo and so forth. So, but that becomes a challenge to some implementation of FBE and FBAE. Just on the free basic energy snapshot, I'm going to give you this. If you look at this,
many years don't rush that much. Okay. When it comes to figures. Okay. Figures through a little bit slowly.
All right. I think let me go slower into this one then to say that this was the report that we got in 2012 that we managed to get, which then in terms of FBAE, were around 69% of the people who are supposed to qualify that were qualifying for different alternative energy using different sources of energy. As you see that KwaZulu-Natal was at 26% for the people who are supposed to qualify for free basic alternative energy, which is mainly the people who doesn't have electricity, which is the West and Northwest. And then there's also Eastern Cape, which is also at the West. The only province that also was supplementing people with mainly it was Free State and Gauteng that were doing a bit better on that, and Western Cape in terms of providing alternative energy on that regard. So seriously, if you look at that, there are households in South Africa that doesn't have get any support in terms of energy at all. They don't have
what does this 113 and 216% mean?
Yeah, I'll just explain that. In terms of the free basic indigenous policies, we will have certain number of people in different municipalities that qualify. But to a certain extent, other provinces and other municipalities, they go overboard. They even some of them give to the all the household. So on that regard, the number becomes high because then the number of people who qualify is low. Then they give it to almost everybody, and other people that don't qualify. So then the percentage becomes skewed. So it means they giving to additional people that not supposed to get electricity, free base electricity. There are those municipalities which give a blanket free basic alternative energy or free basic electricity to everybody, which then it becomes a challenge to say that even the people who have electricity, they do get some tokens for additional alternative energy like gas and so forth. There are those other municipalities that also don't update their indigent, and they just decided to give almost everybody. Then it's skewed a number. It means the people that get free basic alternative energy or free basic energy are more than the indigent people. So that's basically how the number gets skewed. But just to say that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, and some of the contracts might have expired at the moment. It might have went down because it's fluctuating, because usually what municipalities do, they sign short-term contracts with service providers to provide certain service on free basic energy. Whether it's paraffin, when it's other alternative energy. But when it expires, it takes time for them to renew the contract. And also these days, we see municipalities complaining a lot in terms of renewing them and under the issue of finances. Just concluding in terms of free basic alternative energy, to say that it is estimated that the national implementation of free basic electricity is about 70%, as I mentioned, and to the qualifying indigenous. But I'm excluding those customers that I have mentioned, that there are also those who doesn't qualify but that qualify. And the rest of 70% is those who qualify. But this is the combined percentage of free basic electricity and free basic alternative energy. DOE is looking at reviewing the policy in terms of necessitating the new policy development, but even though they are challenged, like for example, the main typical one is that whether the 48 rand is it not outdated because of the it was done a few years ago. But the challenge is that if we increase the 48 rand for free basic alternative energy because the things have gone up, the municipalities are complaining of affordability. And to a certain extent, those municipalities that are complaining for affordability, those poor municipalities, if we increase 48 rand, well, then they afford, because then it means then it shoots up. So it's those compromises that you need to look at. If you rush to review the policy, well, that then not make the matter worse, because then some municipality will say then we can no more afford to implement it because the price is going up every year or it has gone up. So we need to compromise between the two. At least if we were seeing that it was implemented to that extreme, and that the worst part is the problem is with the municipalities that have poor people in the rural areas that are supposed to implement free basic alternative electricity that are not implementing. The municipalities that can afford, like municipalities in around the big cities, they do manage to afford to implement free free basic alternative energy. And the other issue is the criteria used to identify recipients, which I spoke about it, which is in the Indonesian policy. To a certain extent, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to say that who really is supposed to get free basic alternative energy. Never mind the blanket point that whoever doesn't have free basic electricity to qualify for free basic alternative energy. But to a certain extent, a lot of registers of free basic alternatives, it doesn't reflect that. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done at the municipal level to make sure that right people are identified as indigent in terms of energy and they get the benefits that they're supposed to get. The other thing is that due to the lack of monitoring mechanism that I've mentioned for the past few months, there's serious challenges around to say that what is the real figure at the moment in terms of how many people are receiving in the whole country and how many people are not receiving it. It is not a good figure since then, but we fortunately have intervened with the COPTA, and COPTA is working very hard to make sure that they incorporate, they budget more resources to monitor FBS so that they can report to other departments in terms of their mandate as they are distributors of the fund of free basic energy. As you know, the free basic alternative energy, free basic energy's intention is a poverty alleviation, and it is important to challenge. It's an important challenge for the country. The links between poverty and energy are clear. If you do studies, you'll see that people who doesn't have energy, they are basically the poorest of the poor in that regard. And to a certain extent, they need to be subsidized. Or they need to be given free basic energy. So it's an important and a very pivotal issue at the moment while we are battling to get an universal access in South Africa. So we cannot downgrade the issue of free basic alternative energy because it really addresses the issue of the poorest of the poor or the poorest of the poor in that regard. So on that regard, I would like to say thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Batsinjang. Honourable members, Honourable Smale.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we are talking about the poorest of the poor, and it's rightfully said that it's all about the equitable share and how we need to address issues that are to the vulnerable people here. But from the department, and being this your policy where you drive policy and where you take those issues into capital expenditure programs, I would like to know from the department, have we done a cost analysis on renewable projects, especially in places where rural communities are situated, where there is a lack of access to infrastructure, and mainly which I'm talking about is the grid factor. Have we done that cost analysis to say this is what needs to be happening? Because this is where some of our clean energy initiative programs can play a major role in alleviating some of those concerns. A lot of emphasis was put on lack of implementation, lack of reporting, and it comes down to accountability and how you enforce accountability. And a lot of the 283 municipalities that we are sitting in the country, especially the vulnerable provinces that are struggling to implement some of these free basic electricity, are situated in those areas. And the role of NAFSA, making sure that license agreements are being upheld, it's not being upheld, or enforced. And we keep on putting more pressure on municipalities or local authorities that actually cannot deliver because they haven't got these capabilities. And we are talking, our local authorities are situated, are defined in various grades, grade 1, 2 metres. And it's not the bigger municipalities that are really struggling. I think they are coping. It's the lowest, the grade 1, the grade 2, and the grade 3. And it's the incentive schemes of how we attract skilled personnel to assist those local authorities. I'm looking at, and I'm going to take an example here. I've been dealing for the last year and a half trying to get the department to assist the grade 3 municipality to write business plans because it's not happening. And we are saying that there are assistance by the various departments, COFTA, DOE, and SALGA, and ESCOM, to assist with business plans in order to address some of these concerns. But my concern is, why must it take more than a year and a half to assist municipalities to write these business plans? Surely, when local authorities do not come up with the rightful skills or to be able to do those things, at some point your department needs to say, here's your business plan, here's an official that we've transferred into that department to assist to make sure that these things are come. I'm just trying to understand how far does it go or what are the time periods to come to that. Has your department looked at real incentives to assist local municipalities to address the skills concerns that they have, because those officials are normally being paid by on a scale and not necessary on a merit base or equivalent to the academic capabilities of those individuals, but more of that. And I'm looking especially in this field in order to address, is it on the cards? Can it be rolled out? I want to come back to your slide number 17, where we talk about stats and figures, and which links to 19 with your snapshot at free basic energy. We are referring to census figures 2001, but your audit, I think, was done most recently possible information that you are getting from local municipalities into drawing up these certain percentages. My concern is this. I think it's probably worse off now than what it is now. Should we be looking at 2011 figures, census figures, and we would bring that into, and we would bring the rollout of municipalities of a year ago, because I don't know those 1.8 those 3.3 million people that are being assisted, where would that percentage actually lie? Because if a municipality or if a province is exceeding the target of by 113% or by 215%, my argument on the other side is it's not because as they improve the administrative management within those local authorities, they managed to reach out more people, and therefore we can't take actually the figures of 2001, but they've upped the figures during 2005, 2000. You know, as the communities grew, those vulnerable indigenous household members actually also grew in those provinces, and they managed to do more as time goes by. In short, are those figures, would they be looking a lot more different percentage-wise if we look at 2011 census figures? I think that will give a bit of a more updated version of what the real situation is on the ground. I will come back later on. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Honourable
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I mean, this presentation is very interesting. I mean, it's a vitally important topic, but it just kind of reinforces to me the fact that I think we need a rethink on a lot of different policies, because these things are very integrated. I mean, to me, when you're speaking to problems of issues around the distribution sector in general, and clearly we need a vision for how we're going to deal with distribution. I mean, it's not just a failure in terms of free basic electricity, it's also a failure to invest in municipal infrastructure with regards to electricity distribution. There's a whole bunch of problems wrapped up in there. So we clearly need to get a policy around what we're going to do with the distribution industry in South Africa. Having abandoned REDS now, we still don't have a proper vision for how we're going to deal with it. And I think that when we develop that vision, obviously free basic electricity needs to come in there with the kinds of challenges that you're mentioning. But the other issue that you also need to look at is the fact that I don't think we have a proper household energy policy in South Africa. It was something that was raised by a stakeholder last year as well, and been raised by a number of different stakeholders, is that I think that when we approach these issues, we seem to approach it from the wrong angle. We seem to approach it from policies that have been developed on a kind of national level and said, right, this is what's going to help in terms of filtering down. Actually, maybe we need to change the focus. Let's develop a proper household energy policy that looks at what's happening at households at the moment, particularly poorer households, and have a vision for how we want to change that over the short term, the medium term, and the long term. Because clearly what's happening, for instance, is that 50 kilowatt hours is simply not enough for many poor households. And this is something that we constantly hear. And what we are also seeing is that many households that even have electricity actually choose to use paraffin for cooking because they can't afford the electricity prices, and 50 kilowatt hours is not enough to do that. So let's actually go down to the locus of the household and say, right, what are different households in different parts of the country, rural, urban, high falls, all of those different areas, what are they using as energy carriers? Is this a sustainable way going forward, or do we want to change some of the energy consumption habits? And so, for instance, I think what we need is a combination of a bit of free basic electricity along with, say, for instance, a credit card type of scenario where people can actually go and buy gas, for instance. They can get a certain allocation of gas so that we can start to change the consumption habits at that household level. And then what we do from that point of view, once we've got that household energy policy, is to say, right, what is the institutional underpinnings for this at the moment and what needs to be changed? Because quite clearly, I think giving an equitable share to municipalities and thinking that this is going to suddenly filter down, particularly to poor municipalities where there's not even grid electrification, is simply not happening. We need to, in a sense, make this a conditional grant. We need to be saying that national government is going to give the money for this, but that you have to actually use it in this particular way. And we have to find an institutional mechanism that can allow that to happen. But then lastly, what we also need to do is tie this in with the INEP program. Because clearly what's happening, I'm seeing in rural communities in the Eastern Cape, is that Eskom is saying, we're going to get the grid to you in 5 years' time, therefore you don't qualify for solar, for the Solar Homes Project. And so communities wait for Eskom to come. When Eskom doesn't come in 5 years, these communities sit for 5 years without any form of energy. They don't qualify for the free basic energy. They're not getting any of those benefits. So clearly there's a breakdown there. And I know that the department is working on a new INEP program as well, trying to rectify some of these. But perhaps what we should be doing in that interim period is at least putting up the wires, making a kind of mini grid with a solar farm that can then give a free basic allocation of that solar energy, and then when the grid finally gets there from Eskom, you can connect the solar farm to the grid and feed that energy back. These are the kinds of things that we need to start to interrogate, because clearly a lot of things are not working on those levels, and I think the locus of our focus should be right down at the household level, and how do we have a vision for change in household energy consumption over that period. So it's my kind of challenge to you. I know that you've come with a whole bunch of problems that you're encountering around this, but let's try and change our focus. Let's try and work up and see how we can get the right policies that are going to get delivered on the ground. So, thanks.
Thanks very much, Honorable Khaling. You touched a very, very interesting point of really looking at the policy itself, you know, how we should policy was also circulated amongst us, you know. That I'm not.
Just a quick point. I just want to establish from the presenter whether they, as a department, took a closer look at the indigenous policies of municipalities. What really informs the definition of a person to be classified as indigenous? Because you have, from your presentation clearly, there's no adequate targeting of the resources to where they are supposed to be allocated. And tied up to that, I just want to understand whether targeting resources to those who qualify for the indigenous policy would increase administrative costs on the part of these municipalities, because there are municipalities, clearly from your presentation, who give the allocation to everybody. And so I just want to understand that part. The second question, we had an oversight visit to Eastern Cape, I think could be last year, where we saw a solar project which was to a certain extent vandalized and unutilized by the community. I just want to establish from you also, what are your experiences with regard to some of these projects, and what are the lessons that you have learned that you can meaningfully apply to new projects as we move forward?
First round.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to start with all the questions as they follow, but can I just give, because some of this example will touch base in almost all the projects. The last one that was said by Honorable Muloto, in terms of the thing, in terms of the example that we can talk about in terms of the renewable energy or non-grid. There's a huge experience in terms of this non-renewable project in the rural areas, and the challenge the main challenge that comes is the issue of culture and acceptance of that renewable energy. In the early 2000s, we did have non-grid service providers that we created. But unfortunately, those projects, like Honorable Mulot has mentioned, it came to an extent that these projects fall into a crack, and ultimately some of the service provider withdrew. In KZN, they used to use this word, Lindelani, like we're waiting for the real electricity. This is just not electricity. It's just it's like a startup. We're still waiting for the main cost, which is electricity. So they didn't have a buy-in to say that this is the real electricity that you use and you can use 100% benefits out of it comparatively. So there was issue of theft, there was issue of ultimately not taking care of it and other issues that were not successful, that they want the real grid electricity. So in terms of this, some of them that have dilapidated in terms of operation, some of them are not working and so forth. So we do have that problem in terms of alternative energy or renewable energy that have been there in terms of getting by in that regard. So that is a serious, we do have an experience when it comes to that, and we really need to do a lot of work in terms of convincing the rural people that because of the remote of the area and the affordability to say that to get the grid from your area from where it is, it's going to be more expensive, and in terms of affordability, the government is still planning to give you free entertainment, which is a bigger challenge. Then it comes to a challenge that came to the first question of saying that in terms of the areas, which areas then only for renewable energy or only for alternative energy to that extent? Or is this an area for that will have grid soon? So or it becomes a challenge to say that if it comes to cost analysis of saying that we do have all the areas in South Africa that do have, that already have, we know that this place is purely, it's going to be purely renewable, which renewable projects estimate is around 20 years. It's been a challenge to a certain extent in terms of infrastructure. But to a certain extent, we do have projects that we have identified and in terms of also cost, in terms of where they are. It's so unfortunate that there are areas that still doesn't belong anyway, either to the grid or in the future or they need the renewable. And there's still the debate around ESCOM and different institutions. And we also have some incidents where we had areas where that we identified for renewable and ultimately the grid ultimately came in. So that becomes a challenge when you have to have the cost analysis of renewable projects in terms of which area is really ready for alternative energy or alternative source of generation in terms of that. So some of the rural communities are so far away that the only alternative at the moment is to give them either renewable energies or paraffin or whatever. So those areas, they are clear that they can be given. And some of the areas that are also political, no, not political as such, but they are like things like squatter camps, whereby to a certain extent the municipality is not sure whether those areas will ultimately be need to be connected or they ultimately need to be moved, and there's a lot of other issues clustered around. So we do have the challenges that we still have to clear as the whole country, as different departments, as different institutions to say that which ultimate area in terms of the whole national plan, to say that all the areas, especially those that are not electrified in South Africa, are ultimately in the future meant for this type of energy, so that we can ultimately also be able to make the cost, come up with the cost for different areas of those areas. And I think I didn't go deep into it, but that's how the situation is at the moment. The issue of enforcing accountability is an issue that has been a battle for long. It even was just about to go to the court in a few years. The issue of if the money is given to municipality and municipality decide to use for other reasons. It's a constitutional issues which we then, when we previously, when we brought the policy to different institutions and to even to present it to the to the cabinet, to say that to a certain extent the municipality has a right in terms of service provision, which electricity is part of them. So to a certain extent it becomes difficult to enforce the accountability in terms of the free basic alternative energy. So to a certain extent, the interpretation of some of municipalities in terms of the policy of free basic alternative energy and free basic electricity is to a certain extent is a guideline to them to say that we still have the right to do how we do it because we have the right in terms of the municipality. So it's those constitutional issues that it's really hindering us. And I think I'm going to touch base on it when it comes to electrification, on the question of electrification. And the role of NERSA, it's also limited to a certain extent, and the battle of legalities to say to what extent is NERSA can enforce certain responsibilities to municipalities. Bearing in mind that also when it comes to an issue of free basic alternative energy and free basic energy, it's an issue of social responsibility of the government to a certain extent. So as well as it's funded by government to 100%. So to that extent, to say that including some of the reporting in the role of NERSA to a certain extent, while also the money goes straight to the municipality and the agreement is between municipalities as a service provider to municipality. I mean, the service provider and the municipality, it becomes difficult for us. But those are issues that we really need to come up with a proper accounting for this as a government. But there's an issue of legislation that is involved. And the issue of assisting municipality is very critical. As I've mentioned, that as DOE, we always there to assist those municipalities. But as Honorable has asked, to a certain extent, to what extent we then even implement some officials to some of the municipalities to help. Bearing in mind that the Department of Energy is to a certain extent a new department, to a certain extent, and we're still trying to do a new structure on that regard. And there are limited officials at the regional offices, if not there, especially for energy, for electricity and other sources of energy. They are mainly for petroleum in that extent. But even though we do have electrification officials at the region. But the challenge that you're having is that even though we are short-staffed to a certain extent, the implementation of free basic alternative energy from national level and at Aboriginal offices, we are always there in terms of municipalities, in terms of assisting them. Because the assistance that they need is not like a permanent assistance. It's just like on some few issues to show them the direction in terms of how these things work. So on that regard, we're always there for them. If the challenge lies on the municipalities, ultimately decide to implement and taking a decision to implement and ultimately using funding, budgeting for implementation of free basic alternative energy. So on that regard, in short, the department is still willing to do that, even though we are short staff, to assist municipality at whatever level. But to a certain extent, we're in a permanent basis, I'm not sure, and maybe we also need to relook at where maybe other municipalities or district municipalities might need a permanent officials next to them for some longer period. And I think it's a good proposal. We'll also look at it. The other thing is that on the other question of census 2001, the reason why we used the 2001 year, well, the first point of departure is that this report is outdated. It's August, and the 2011 has just been released. But the other thing is that the percentage was right by then. So for now moving forward, we're going to use the new census in order to identify the poor in line with the South Africa, and also ultimately coming up with the percentage of how many people are receiving comparatively. So I think it's a good point on that regard. And when we were checking the figures to in terms of indigenous, some of the municipalities, I mean, some of the provinces have went up in terms of the indigenous people, but some might have gone down a bit. But averagely, the number of people that are poor might be a bit higher comparatively, because then it's all in the definition of who's poor, how many people are getting certain amount of money per household to that extent, in line with the definition of South Africa. So good point indeed, but from now onward, we're going to be using Census 2011. We need to rethink on the policies of EDI. Of course, all these policies, they talk to each other on that regard. So especially when it comes to the distribution as a whole, because there's a lot of other challenges that are in the distribution. But going forward, as you know, that the main issue around EDI or electricity distribution at the distribution level, the challenge was maintenance. Well, there are programs that are ongoing in terms of assisting municipality in terms of maintenance, but they are intertwined in terms of issues of implementation of electrification, in terms of implementation of free basic electricity and other renewable projects, and so forth. So to a certain extent, as we go on, I think it's where the department needs to focus in terms of how do we then intervene, because EDI is bigger than maintenance and rehabilitation and maintenance. There are other issues related to that. So I think as the department now, we need to refocus and look at other issues beyond that. And the issue around policy for local government, when we started with the free basic alternative energy and free basic electricity, we have done a lot of pilot projects. And what we've done, we have chosen different types of municipalities. We have chosen poor municipalities in urban areas, in different types of municipalities, and different. Actually, it was the whole samples of all municipalities in throughout the country. So on that regard, then if you look at our policies in terms of free basic electricity and free basic energy, it has an alternative. It has a it encompasses all types of municipalities to a certain extent, whether it's a poorer municipality to a certain example, or a municipality that has certain type of source of energy, as I said, is geographical. It's an option for them to say. So it to a certain extent is a national, but it's for municipality to choose certain type of policy that suits them mainly. But to a certain extent, further work still needs to be done in terms of also making sure that different municipality. But to a certain extent, municipality have the right also to say that in line with the national policy, we then have our own policy guideline that will then limit our policies to be direct to municipalities, and the department is always ready to help on that regard. The issue of INEP grants, let me just, my point of departure is that there was a proposal that maybe we need to implement free basic electricity with INEP while we're also looking at the new way of implementing INEP. Bearing in mind that the electrification program started even before the constitution in 1994, and the I'm not saying the INEP is unconstitutional, but the way it was implemented, it was those clauses that I mentioned in the constitution to a certain extent, INEP can deal directly to the municipality in terms of implementation. So when we came up with free basic electricity, it was after 1996 when the constitution came in, and to say that we now have to comply to the constitution. So on that regard, we needed to recognize the issue that municipality has the right to service provider. That's why the money didn't come to DOE, then went to DECO, COPTA, to municipality in line with the F-grant. And to a certain extent, we could link have that condition. And the issue of putting a condition, that it becomes a challenge to say that as soon as you put a condition of free basic alternative energy to say that thou shalt use this money for free basic alternative energy, it becomes a challenge that you are unconstitutional to say that you then forcing municipalities to implement their services in a different way or in the way that they don't approve. So in that regard, the ultimate approval that you got was that the money is supposed to come through GPE to municipality.
But on the same breath, I'm not a lawyer, but if you then say the very person has got a constitutional right to free electricity because of his or her socio-economic status, which is being the poorest of the poor, being indigent, how about that then?
I think it's a debate that has been ongoing all along. I think maybe we need to come up with that topic again as a national government. It's not just about free basic electricity. It's about free basic water. It's about free basic
services.
Free basic services as a whole, to say that this is, as a department, as national departments, we can then be able to implement it directly. Because in a previous debate, we failed the debate to say that we cannot because of the constitutional matter. Maybe we need to take it back to the table and discuss it further. Maybe can change that to legislation or agree on that matter.
No, carry on, sorry to just interject.
Yeah, I think I've done it. The issue of indigenous policies, the issue of indigenous policy is a very serious problem. When we had a lot of committees in previous years to try and assist municipalities and agree on terms of indigenous policy, we had three alternatives. The first alternative is that we don't have any other free basic policy. We align ourselves with the state of South Africa. Whoever has been said in terms of it will be poor, but to a certain extent, the challenge there was that is not sustainable. A person, when the census was being done in 2011, was poor. After 2 years, he got the director post. It's no more. I'm just giving an example. It's no more a poor person. And those challenges, or the councillor is normally a poor person, so it needs updating. So the census one was out. And the second part is that we then go into the same clause to say that municipality, to a certain extent, has the right in terms of having their own policies and identifying who's poor and who's not poor. And to a certain extent, when you look at the responsibility of a councillor at the lower level, he's supposed to know his community and supposed to know who does he qualify for RTP house, who does he qualify for a free basic alternative energy, and to a certain extent, bearing in mind that as government we always having priorities, we don't have enough money to give to the poor. So then the councillor will be able to, in terms of the money that I get, I'll identify certain type of poor. So those issues of indigenous policy, then it was a second issue. Let the municipality determine their indigenous policy. And the third option was to have a national policy on that regard. The national policy in terms of indigenous becomes an issue of then customization to certain municipalities to that extent. Well, that policy will then say that because it's given, a poor person in Soweto is not a poor person in Karoo, in a rural area in Eastern Cape or in Norway. So the definition, and also the issue of affordability. The Gauteng, I mean, the Joburg municipality can afford to give a poor person, maybe even just giving an example on FPE, maybe getting 100 kilowatt per hour every month. But the municipality in Eastern Cape cannot even afford to give 20 kilometers or 20% of the people who are supposed to receive. So there's an issue of availability. There's also an issue of different municipalities might be having different different understanding of what is the poor person on that regard. So the final agreement was that on that regard, the each and every municipalities, we did have a guideline at COPTA, which we done COPTA has it, just a guideline, bank guideline of what is a free, what is in terms of indigenous policy and who is the poor person. But we also then agreed to say that all municipalities should have their own indigenous policies in line with the understanding of the real responsibilities of giving service to the poor. Even though some of the instances you'll find that if the municipalities are close to each other, we'll find adjacent household getting different type of services, which is always a challenge in all the services because it's different municipalities. But on that regard, on that responsibility of municipalities, different municipalities are supposed to have indigenous policy. We do have even some of the municipalities today that don't even have indigenous policies for now. And on that regard, they just either giving any other list that they get from councillors, or when they have to identify people supposed to qualify for certain benefits, or they, if it's electricity, they just go to Eskom and say, Eskom, give us the list of the people staying in that village who are receiving, who are consuming less than this, then they give to them. So it's just a haphazard thing. But in terms of the present status, each and every municipality supposed to have their own indigenous policy and identify who's supposed to be poor. The challenge that you got is that for you to have indigenous household policy, you need to have indigenous register. And having indigenous register, you need to maintain it. And some of the municipality tried and said, no, we better give to everybody, because even maintaining this indigenous policy, there's more burden in terms of administration, there's more burden in terms of funding. So it's cheaper for us to even have more, broad base to FBA or come up with our own policy, because even most of the municipalities don't update this register, because frequently as quite possible we need to update it to check whether that person is still poor or is still qualified to get free basic alternatives, and which then is a cost to municipalities. So to a certain extent, we do have those challenges where we try to help municipalities. Unfortunately, to a certain extent, it goes to an issue of funding and then legislative to say that to what extent is the national government supposed to end in terms of assisting. And to a certain extent, the issue of indigenous policy is just like that. Let municipality give us a list of indigenous people so that service providers should do that, and they also facilitate the contract. We just assist in terms of skills and other technical skills that are needed. I think I've answered all the questions, Chairperson. Thanks.
Honourable members, any follow-up? Yes, Honourable Smale.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I do think that because we've got a slow rollout program, and because of the economic situations that various provinces are experiencing, and we saw it in the 2011 census, that urbanization has come about mainly towards Gauteng and towards the Western Cape. People looking for greener pastures. And you did slightly touched on the topic of smart metering, or for a better word, prepaid systems, which also then looks in addressing the people or the communities that did benefit of free basic alternative energy, but due to circumstances they moved to these situations, but not necessarily improving their own economic situation or their basic income, but just to be closer to better infrastructure and some of those things. I do note that people that has been exposed to prepaid metering is just about 3 million, around about 3.23. That was the last figures that was made available around about 2005 that I could pick up. And knowing that 47% of our country's people is poor, is there a holistic approach or actually a rollout program by yourselves or by the department in actually addressing this concern, also assisting those in order to benefit? Because if I can't get you electricity, I'll go to a place where I can get, but then the beneficiation on the other side. And I know it's more onto policy, but I need to understand: is it there? What are we doing? What is it that we are putting there for local authorities in order to address these issues? In the context of skills at local authorities that are struggling to deal with the big amounts of debt that they need to write off, in the context of lost of electricity, those are connections that are not illegal connections, let me put it in that way. And I'm trying to see that when we address this issue, and then when we tackle this issue, that we actually tackle the other half that is created because this issue is not, because this program is not efficiently being addressed and being able to run off, and it's because of our challenges. I do understand that, but there's another problem that has been created, that has been put out in the 2011 census, that we need to strictly deal with, and these are the people that are coming to the urban areas, and they are, as you rightfully said, they come with their own new challenges, and I'm just like to, in a short way, to see if that's been addressed.
From my side, I think the first thing is cash paid, I would say, I can't kushish our LDR alone. I'm far from being satisfied by either the department itself and even the municipalities in terms of addressing both free basic electricity and free basic alternative energy as part of free basic services. Notwithstanding the fact that there are a number of challenges that you have raised, and that's a signal that from my side, I would like us to grapple with this for some time. This is just the continuation of the journey which we started at free basic electricity level, because this is part of free basic services.
And there is a fundamental reason beyond just constitutionality obligation that all these instruments have been introduced. It's about being a caring government. It's about ensuring that our transformation in South Africa is meaningful. And transformation can be meaningful when you cater and address the needs and problems and challenges for various social sectors in terms of how they experience them. Now the indigent in Baptist ruler. First of all, you've raised something very interesting in slide 8 about the mandate of municipalities in respect of free basic electricity, that of municipal health services, that they then influence the support of certain fuels, if I understand. If you would just help me with the details when you say certain fuels, because it's quite interesting when you raise this matter in the context of health services. Surely, that then focuses on health, the bias is on clean energy. The second one is on slide 10, the third bullet, where you say a pilot study suggested that range of kilowatt hours. But one of the interesting things you raise there is limited heating, which is, I would just understand, limited space heating, but the emphasis is on limited. Now, once you say limited, that immediately indicates that people or the users cannot just, or consumers cannot just use whatever energy or electricity willy-nilly. It's limited. Now, the question, how do they know? Or the converse of it, that has there been anyone else campaign? To what extent have those awareness campaigns been implemented? What has been the impact of those awareness campaigns? Who has been driving them? Whether it's national or municipality, because you say limited. You didn't say lighting, media access, heating. You said it around heating, limited heating. Sorry to re-emphasize. That indicates that amongst other things, an area where there's visibly high consumption of electricity or energy, let me just say, take it generically, but it's limited in this state. So there is an obligation, one or another, that there must be an attempt, and a serious one too, to ensure that there's an awareness that what is provided when it comes to that form of consumption, there must be limitations. Slide 12, maybe I lost my concentration here, but I'll still ask anyway. You say the free basic electricity does not also accumulate if not used and cannot be claimed prospectively. Is that the same for free basic alternative energy? In terms of the lack of indigent policies, the registration verification, particularly its management of the record, I'm going to give you a very interesting thing. There is a municipality called Dukanji, a Komani, formerly known as Queenstown. Fortunately, the mayor there is my comrade, we met in December. Talking other outside politics, I asked him about energy issues, and I came to the indigency issue. His immediate response was just very fast and instinctive. No. We took unemployed, even unemployed graduates in particular. We are using them to clean up the indigency register. He acknowledged that it is a problem, but he didn't show any millimeter out of strength of stress around fixing up the register. I think from now onwards, honourable members, I will not be impressed with any municipality that will give
an excuse that it's such a burdensome or cumbersome or whatever issue. Here is a very practical situation. And the county is not a financially well-off municipality. They are actually under pressure even in terms of providing adequate or getting adequate electricity itself. But with this one, I think we'll have to take it from there. This has been raised in the past, but just as my comment, I've had a very interesting direct experience that can be handled. Because why I'm raising and stressing this, honorable members, both for free basic electricity and free basic alternative energy, is because time and again we are told about this excuse that it's so cumbersome to establish the register and to maintain it. But there are a number of other instruments and programs within the government that can be used to address it. Here is one example. Not that it's the only one. In the same slide, you say lack of communication, although there's on communication for various stakeholders. If you could just share with us who are those stakeholders. In the same slide, you speak of COCTA facilitating remedial action on the lack of reporting, monitoring, and evaluation systems. But out of interest, is there any formal report between yourselves and COCTA on that? Because once again, this has very strong implications, because they keep on pouring money, whether it goes through National Treasurer, but at the end of the day, the constitutional mandate or political obligation is for Department of Energy to ensure that there's universal access of energy to everyone, electricity in this sense. So is there any way where you have structured any relation, probably not only for this, but even for other things, vis-a-vis electricity? So I won't say necessarily there should be a formal agreement or arrangement for this issue only. It could be part of a broader arrangement. Just slide 19 regarding the snapshot on free basic energy. One first comment is that it would be very helpful to have a snapshot or a similar snapshot on free basic alternative energy at some stage. I'm not sure whether the national census has been helpful enough to facilitate generation of that information. But my question is here on this slide is that KZN and Northwest are very, very low. Why so low, 26% and 22%? And also okay, some members have already made observation about this. It's of people who do not qualify, but only for me to emphasize that once again, surely somewhere a policy review, probably we need to ensure that that's addressed, you know, in its earnest. I know we've raised this, but once again in our conclusion, you say the lack of monitoring mechanism makes it difficult to establish accurate figures. Maybe someone from COCTA or anyone should tell us allocations from National Treasury, when do they become conditional? When do they not become conditional? Because my immediate reaction there was that why is this not a condition that will give you money unless you show us how you're going to monitor and how you're going to account? I know in terms of INEP, there's been also that tough going with municipalities, you know, lack of accountability and things. Probably what one is trying to say, why should this be so different or separate, you know? More of a comment.
I think that's all for now. I've done less comments, and if you could just take us through your responses so that we can take this first part of our meeting to a closure.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson, maybe let's start with an issue of urbanization as the honorable member has asked. I think it's a very critical question that goes to the reflection in terms of the present census. There's a lot of, when I was saying that some of the municipalities have increased in terms of poor people, it's clear that some of the big cities have got a lot of people floating, looking for jobs and so forth. So even in terms of a population growth, you'll find that some of the bigger cities, I mean, bigger city provinces are growing comparatively to some of them in terms of the number of people that are coming in. And that then brings other dynamics in terms of the whole service implementation and service how the government implements services. The issue of free basic alternative energy then becomes an energy question. If you look at some of the challenges that the municipality have, if those people come, they ultimately then push the number of squatter camps to certain areas and to certain they put the number of squatter camps at a high, because most of them, because they come poor to the urban areas looking for job, they ultimately have squatters and so forth. So in that regard, there's a need for alternative energy to some of those quota camps, to some of the municipalities. So it becomes a challenge. And to a certain extent, we do have provinces that also, especially those so-called urban, I'm not labeling the province here, with like housing, where they have limited implementation of FBAE because they are concentrating on other level of other people. So it becomes a challenge to those municipalities. But for sure, urbanization has brought a skewed or another analogy when you understand the service implementation on that regard. And that needs to be taken care of. And the issue of disconnection then becomes a problem to even to some of the areas that to say that if the areas, there are a lot of poor people in some areas and there's a lot of disconnections to a certain extent, then it becomes the issue of customers owning the municipalities, which then becomes the responsibility of municipalities to try and assist and make sure that those people pay the electricity, whereas there's also a service provider issue, which then becomes difficult in terms of ultimately this challenge of implementing free basic electricity. The smart metering has become one of the possible solutions to this challenge. But in terms of smart metering, if you look at the present standard that has been released that we're using from SAPS, there's a lot of other things that is required on a standard smart metering that we want in the country. So on that regard, that includes that element where we can be able to communicate with the customer or even send the units to the customer at a certain period. So on that regard, it will be a help to either to free basic energy program. So, of course, the whole program of metering, it has just started, unfortunately. Some of the projects are still ongoing. There's an issue of funding because smart metering in terms of the standard becomes more expensive because there's a lot of other things that they have put in that metering. So until then, we have smart meters at the rural areas to a certain extent that can assist us also in terms of FBE. It's still a bit of a challenge to that regard. Just drilling straight to the smart metering to say that, of course, the Department of Energy has been very vocal in terms of implementation of smart metering as a solution to most of the problems in electricity. But we had a problem of funding and so forth because it requires a lot of funding. And some of the projects are ongoing. Some of the projects, we just got some approval of some other funding to start implementing them in a different municipalities. And we're hoping that as time goes on, National Treasury will also release more money for smart metering so that we get the solution for, we get better solution for free basic alternative energy. And in terms of the responsibility, mainly it's in terms of local municipalities, especially those who have service providers to assist us in terms of implementation of those programs. So the program has just started, but unfortunately the funding is still limited, and we're hoping that the program will go very well and smooth. The issue of health on that slide that talked about issue of health on the municipality side in terms of the mandate. From the clean energy perspective, we are preaching, or maybe because I'm a preacher, we are emphasizing on clean energy to that extent because it has been identified as energy is one of the cause of some of the challenges in health, especially in the rural areas. I'll give you an example. The example of a coal in Baula, I don't know what they call it. In Baula, it has carbon monoxide when you put it in a house and carbon dioxide to a certain extent. And ultimately, in terms of health perspective, it ultimately endangers some people's life, or even some other people end up losing their life because of inhalation of that. And it's a given and it's a known fact. That's why even the department has previously came up with the so-called Passenger Gamakoko, I can't call it properly, program, which is a typical Mbaola, which is more healthier, which can be able to limit the carbon dioxide monoxide the way the coal is being burnt. So the issue of health becomes very pivotal on that regard, and it's beyond that. Even paraffin. Paraffin, it goes to even an issue of safety also, to say that if you look at the old stores of paraffin, typically not too far from here in Guguletu, where you have a lot of incidents where people are burning because of paraffin. The issue of health becomes very pivotal on that regard. And the municipality need to be part of that in order to make sure that they have input in terms of what type of alternative energy do we bring in. If we bring coal, do we take the third grade or the fifth grade if it's there of coal, or what type of coal do we bring to the people? And the usage part of it should be clean. So that's the part where I was emphasizing on the health part. And never beside the point, the issue of health in clean energy in the future is very pivotal on that regard. And I like to get into the issue of a debate that has been going all along in terms of limited heating that the chairperson has raised. Let me start by saying that the issue of who is the poorest of the poor. Because when the issue of free basic services was introduced, we said the poorest of the poor. To what extent is it the poorest of the poor? Is it the person who doesn't have anything at all? Because it's a very diverse definition. It goes from even not just energy, even goes to SASA to say that who does he qualify to say that this is the poorest of the poor. And to a certain extent, when you question to say that 50 kilowatts or 30 kilowatts is very limited, to what extent do you say that? The point that I'm getting is to say that when in 2003, 4, 5, when we were doing a research with UCT in terms of, we took all this definition and then when we were doing the pilot studies, we say that this is the benchmark. And ultimately to say that for the issue of affordability and so forth and so forth, let the poorest of the poor be people who use electricity to this extent. That's why then we use comrade. That's why chairperson use this word limited heating. Limited heating on that regard doesn't ultimately saying that there's a difference between the poorest of the poor and a person who's just normal. Because the poorest of the poor will find that he only uses electricity for once, for maybe ironing or maybe just cooking soft things. Most of the thing he used an alternative energy. When he cooks, he cooks, he go and talk the wood, he cooks outside and whatever. So we find that, okay, these poor people, this is how they survive, and this was a benchmark in terms of that. And that from that extent, we find that in terms of an average of those poorest of the poor, they're using electricity around 40 to 50 kilowatts per per month in terms of electricity, if they do have electricity. So in that regard, that's why the policy benchmark to say that in terms of the study, we're saying the poorest of the poor use electricity between 30 kilowatt hour per month to 60. So let's say 50. But increasing it, then it means then we're defining extra poor to say that we're adding additional what level of the poorest of the poor. But the person who doesn't have a jacuzzi, who doesn't have any other things that you can think of, he doesn't really use electricity to that extent. They use limited electricity. So even when it comes to heating, they don't cook most of the time with electricity because they know that electricity is most of the time cost them more, they don't have. So they just decide to use alternative energy or other source of energy for cooking. So the definition was that for the poorest of the poor, which is that person, that old gogo, that old whoever was the poorest of the poor, let the person qualify for free basic services. So that was the definition, the starting point of saying that heating is not inclusive. So, but then maybe the economics has changed, that the country has developed and the poorest of the poor has changed. Is it? When you talk about the poorest of the poor, the person who doesn't have an all in South Africa, it has gone to a certain extent when then a person can be able to do certain things, enjoy some benefits, have two fridges in the house, then we can say that now the poorest of the poor, the country is getting richer, then we can define it. But I'm just putting those dynamics around the definition of the poor of the poor. Alright. The other issue is accumulation.
Yeah, but the emphasis is, have you done the awareness campaign? I understand the definition, that's fine, good. But the thing is, you said limited, which means there was a conscious decision to say, we will not say we are giving you for just general heating purposes. Like you and me, Honorable Smale, we can heat as much as we can. We know that we'll have to pay. But if you say that we are giving you free electricity, but bear in mind, when it comes to heating, it has to be limited. Surely, on that respect, you've got to give a certain awareness in whatever form that your consumption in this area has got to be limited. It may not be right because, I mean, a poor person's body is like mine. You know, it should be just warmed like any other thing, but there was a contrast, focus. But that's what I want to hear. I'm not putting you in a corner, but I think we need to know the facts as they are, so that on behalf of Parliament, we can take, the appropriate decisions, as to how do we, bring about any remedial action if there needs be a remedial action in that respect. Sorry to take it back. If you could just help us on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's a very good input in that regard, but also the question goes to an issue of the other question of communication, to what extent is this thing communicated? Starting from the policy perspective, to say that in the policy we have even given an example of limited heating, to say that in terms of limited heating is this and this and this and this, because those are basic needs of the poor. So to that extent, when it comes to communication, to say that then are we communicating to municipality on that? Of course, the policy, they do read, but we ought to. Further than that, we do have pamphlets, we do have communication, and we have monthly meetings with different provinces that invite all the municipalities to come and talk about these things. And beyond that, the other stakeholders that include COCTA, that include SALGA, that include ESCOM, that have pamphlets, that has interventions in regard to all the communication strategy when we start or when we implement free basic alternative energy. It might not be to that extreme, because communication also to a certain extent costs different institutions. What you can just say is that it may be insufficient to a certain extent, but to a certain extent, to implementing agencies and to all the other institutions, it's clear and in the policy and within our communication instruments. The problem is that is it enough or not enough, which for my opinion says that it's not so enough, which also I think the department has mentioned it, but it's so unfortunate that the implementation also is very slow, so it's a compromise between spending money on the communication while the also municipalities are very implementing some other free basic alternative energy very slow. I take the point, Chairperson. The issue of indigenous register, which you have given an example, it's a serious challenge. And the question of that you're raising is that how is it done, cost effectively so or expensively so? It's a question. Beyond that, it's a matter of willingness to municipality to make sure that how they do it, or they do it at all, they don't do it at all. The problem is that some of the municipalities, they don't even do it, even if it's in a cheaper way, like you have mentioned in example of Eastern Cape. And to that extent, when they have to implement a certain program that is related to free basic to basic energy or to free basic things, it becomes a challenge that they give you a stale register which have names of the people which doesn't qualify. So on that regard, it becomes a challenge to national
government. I know we need to conclude. But how do they give you? Do they give you hard copies?
What is basically happening is that in line with the service provider, we then request the list of indigents, then they will submit it to the
hard copy.
Well, they will have list of houses and of different of whatever. It comes in different ways.
But the ICT is in this. And the very best way is of ensuring, you know, software designing is done, software programming is done in different ways that you can even independently update that. Sorry to interject, I mean, but that's another thing. There are creative ways of ensuring that that gets updated, you know. But of course, I do take those who studied it on a wrong footing, probably may have to correct it manually. But at some stage, we would like to hear stories that, look, we've got some municipalities which are creating models of how this, indigency registry, you know, practice or mechanism, you know, is state of art. I don't think even half of the municipalities or 40% of it, just some 5-10% which you can make them point of reference to others, you know. But this has been coming on time and again, and look, we also operate on the ground. We can see, we can relate to how this can be improved. Granted that for struggling municipalities, there's something, but surely, you know, to create an environment where the indigent, the poorest of poor, are going to be denied what is rightfully theirs. Remember, the lady from National Treasury that day was sitting this side. She said, look, I'm watching people talking here, and we've got 12 billion going back into the coffers. I mean, sorry, this is what triggers me, honorable members. 12 billion going back, not used, which is supposed to have gone to, you know, the welfare and well-being of a poor person. Okay, honorable Smiley, sorry, bro.
Jefferson, just maybe for future references, the department made us aware that there are a static register or some local authorities that does not provide certain information, or you struggle to get those information. I would like this committee actually to be given some sort of a reference to say, of the 283 municipalities, these are the ones that are doing so that we look at the extent of percentage towards local authorities. Maybe it's 2% or 3% municipalities that is not complying. Maybe the problem is much bigger than what we are seeing. In order for us to then come up with certain strong mechanisms in order to deal with that, in order to, so that we can make sure that this department is provided with the relevant information in order to drive policy, in order to make sure that these programs are being rolled out the way that we think that it should be rolled out.
Can you make that format? Can you work with COCTA, your COCTA counterpart? Bring us, share with us a profile, you know, of the around the whole indigency registry, you know, environment. Which municipalities have got them? Which ones are struggling? Which ones are questioning their own registries? Which ones are running well? You know, why are they running well? What are the challenges? Who are those who have challenges? What remedial action plans do they have on the ground? And then we can take it from there. Please, if that could be done, let's put time frame within a month, folks, from now. Thank you. Okay, you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I think those were good points. I also wanted to go to the to Rob Inkofta. And even the next point that I think that also we should put it on the agenda when the Inkofta's here, which is the issue of a reporting in terms of how is the reporting done under the auspices that if the money is given to municipalities, they have to report, and then you can also DOE be part of it. But just in a short sense to say that we do have a national task team in terms of FBS, where we then have have all the reports from different institutions. Even ESCOM is part of that meeting for where they implement, and some of the municipalities that have their own service providers, then will then have a national report on that regard, which we frequently have, and it's coordinated by COFTA to that extent. So the issue of reporting and the issue of indigenous register, can we then pack it for the COFTA so that we should be part of it? But in a nutshell, we do have a report that comes, and we have a relationship with COFTA on that regard. They do have a section that now works with the FBS and FBE. I think that was the last question. If I, we're still working on that, whether to what extent we have to review the policy, as the chairperson has asked. That, yeah, maybe as we go on, we need to review the policy and put the new changes within the policy. Yes, we will be soon, but I don't have a time frame yet because there was an issue whether is it now or later because of the lack of implementation. But I think when you look at the policy development and implementation, is in terms of what time, and it is in terms of the necessity from the community and stakeholders. So, but it seems as if there's a serious call from that extent. So the issue of reviewing of the policy is busy becoming urgent as time goes on. I think that's it. And also that's from the Munich also. It's an issue that I think we should also pack it for COFTA where departmental support it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I know municipalities are challenged, but the extent to which they get creative to address their challenges is also an important factor to take into account kind of them. You can't say complete victim, and, you know, because we also hear all sorts of other stories of financial mismanagement as well. Let's be brutally honest as well about that. Yeah, so. What's the story then? I mean, also I've given an example. Queenstown is not well-to-do municipality financially, but look, here's the leadership which has come with a very, you know, creative solution to this. I'm sure sometime this year they'll be having a very, you know, well-refined, you know, indigenous register. Look, can we conclude by saying that I see two or three, you know, key areas coming out of that. Not to repeat everything, but thanks, honourable members, and thanks to the department, you know, for raising this. But at the end of the day, this shows that this is just one of the unfinished chapters in the work that we are doing in energy, also in attending or addressing the needs and the challenges of the poor. The first one is the policy reviewers. I'm not saying policy reviewers. Whether they are within our ambit or you've got to interact with others, Free Basic Electricity itself, although we're here for Free Basic Alternative Energy, that's obviously strongly linked. The indigency issues, probably it would be helpful to explore with your counterparts whether there shouldn't be a national policy framework, then which each and every municipality can readapt, because there are obviously metros in there. Really, rural municipalities, if you can give them that name. So a one-size-fits-all wouldn't necessarily be helpful. It has always been raised, even before, even now, reiterated, the household energy policy. Somehow, we really have to have someone, you know, bearing himself or herself on research work, putting together something in this area. And also around appliances as well. You know, the extent to which you can talk about Free Basic Alternative Energy without addressing accessibility of appliances. And also their safety. One of the members in December, we just went to Bureau of Standards, and you know, memory comes back, you know, as to how important it is to have, you know, safe and reliable appliances.
particular for alternative energy in this regard. But the also the area of operations, just how they are managed, you know, a lot has been raised around that, the maintenance of existing things, the indigent register, as I say, accountability, coordination and cooperation amongst the various, spheres of government. The smart strategy, I say smart strategy, because the smart grid, the smart technology, the smart everything, you need to ensure that probably where it is being introduced or piloted, we see how it factors in free basic alternative energy and even free basic electricity for that matter, honorable members. And the other area is stakeholder engagement as well as awareness campaigns. You may say there's no money, but the thing is the extent to which people receive and respond to services is fundamentally important. You can pour billions, not just millions, but if people don't receive and use the services appropriately, you know, it's an issue, and a big issue too. And whereas investment in stakeholder engagement and awareness campaign can just be equally important, such that it helps on the appropriate utilization of the services that are being provided. And in this regard, what we're talking about, because yes, the indigent has got to respond properly, or just citizens or residents, such that they are able to, you know, help municipalities to give them the correct information where necessary. Remember, once again, one of the things that triggers me around limited heating is illegal connections. Yes, illegal connections and the abuse and rampant abuse at that level. So investing in stakeholder and engagement of whatever forms and awareness campaigns is just as important. Just recently I was reminding ESCOM of the homework they have. One time they told us of regional electricity forums. They gave us the first document, and I raised a couple of questions on the first report, and they need to come back to us and see the extent to which those regional electricity forums are helpful. And I'm just raising them because that's amongst other, a whole range of tools, a platform that can be used to ensure that things like this are being raised as well. Honorable members, I think we've been at it. Let's take a break, a 10-minute break, so that we can come back for the biofuel strategy. Thank you very much, Dr. Bazinga. I know it has been tough, but it's going to be tougher because we're not going to let go for this one. Not for a long time. Thank you.
I'm all right.
Yeah.
Hi, how's it? I'm good, thanks. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know.
I'm not exercising. I'm not using anything. I'm just enjoying my body.
I know. I just don't know.
About 15 minutes left to record on my. I don't think I thought we came to buy a few.
Yes, I was wondering, oh my, why they're not talking about.
About 15 minutes left.
Is it 15 minutes on your battery? Or on your card?
On my card.
And you can delete everything that happens before now. Anyone can delete everything that happened this morning because it's nothing. But you know what, I'm telling Isabel, I'm telling her now that they're talking about something else. So I'm telling her that so that they'll still do that after tea break.
What?
Five years? waiting for her to come back to me. No, I'm just waiting for Isabel to come back to me. I'm thinking we delete everything that's been said all morning, because really it's... I was telling her that this is don't ever stop, there's nothing else. I think I don't know, they're not talking about the bicycles I came here for. They're talking about free basic electricity. So all that stuff means nothing. Monday. Tuesday, I check. Now I'm trying to, good, I don't know the feeling when I'm not here, man. I'm being. Hey. I'm not even worried about whether it's hot or cold now. How Johnny? Huh? Kukona, kukona is a good song, occupy if he was a city.
Can we start settling? Okay, Memo did. At long last, you have brought us the update of the on the biofuels in the South strategy. I suppose as part of our diversification of energy sources in the country. The floor is yours. Welcome again.
Okay, thanks. Good morning, or midday. Protocol of that. As the chair has already said, my name is Mohadi Mudise, which is Director for Clean Energy. Maybe before I start, I just need to highlight the point that the strategy that is for public comments is for energy efficiency, not the biofuel one. But like we're going to give update in terms of how have we progressed in relation to the implementation thereof. The presentation outline will look at the introduction.
Just on that. I'm sure you'll take us through as to all this. There's a cabinet resolution on 26 October 2011. So, fine. It will form part of this update as to the status of the strategy. Thank you.
Okay, the outline, now look at the introduction, South African biofuels aspirations, update on licensing of biofuels manufacturing facilities, biofuels regulatory framework, some ongoing and outstanding biofuels task team activities, cabinet resolutions of October 2011, and closing remarks. Just the introduction is just to indicate that in the South African context, a specific requirement for the biofuels industrial strategy was to create a link between the first and second economies, a requirement that entails creating jobs in underdeveloped areas. Government recognizes that clear government policy, regulations, and incentives are a prerequisite for the development of the biofuels industry. Even though biofuels, like most renewable fuels, require incentives in order to be cost competitive with the conventional, their upside is that such incentives also account for benefits such as job creation, balance of payment savings, energy supply security, and economic growth that is fairly stable. All these benefits contribute to supporting a better life for all, both now and in the future. Basically, I mean poverty alleviation as well as economic development. Most importantly, the estimate as per the 2006 feasibility study conducted by former DME revealed that the targeted 2% biofuel scenario can create about 25 jobs. Government's intention is to only allocate the producer or investor incentive to projects that involve expansion that assist in achieving the 2% target. You would recall that the strategy emphasizes the development of biofuels within the former homelands or the underutilized areas. Hence, we're talking about this 2%. And the commendable ground has been covered in pursuit of realizing South Africa's biofuel aspiration. With that, we need to link it to the 2013 target. This 2% biofuels penetration, which is approximately 400 million liters per annum into the national liquid fuels pool. And the objectives of the strategy were to contribute towards the achievement of the national renewable energy policy target. Hence, we're talking about the 2013 target, which was, I mean, the 10,000 gigawatt hour. Also contribute towards improving energy security in the country, contribute towards the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, facilitate rural economic development through job creation, SMMEs, development, and others. Stimulate agricultural production in the underutilized agricultural areas of the country, as I said before, and integrate historically disadvantaged farmers, especially in the former homelands, into the mainstream agricultural and energy economies. This is an update of the biofuels, the licensing of biofuels manufacturing facilities. The slides basically depict the kind of biofuels that have been issued with licenses or granted. The first one, we have got Arengo 316, which is the plant type is the sorghum base, where the capacity expected is 90 million liters per annum. The location is Credoc in the Eastern Cape, and in this case, the status is granted. If you look at the note, the footnote of the slide, I did try to explain what granted means. The applicant has not met all the requirements, but now is in possession of a conditional manufacturing license. And where the status says issued, it means the applicant has met all the requirements and is now in possession of a manufacturing license. So all in all, or overall, this is the status of where we're sitting in the licensing process based on the plant type and the location and the status of where we are. Only number six, the phytoenergy, a canola-based biofuel, which is biodiesel, which is expected to more than 500 million liters per annum, is still in the initial stages of license application. But the total capacity for all the plants that we are looking at, we're looking at over a billion. Existing biofuels incentive. Currently, bioethanol falls outside the fuel tax net and is therefore 100% tax exempt. Fuel tax exempted. And then the biodiesel falls within the fuel tax net by being, given a rebate of 50% on the general fuel levy. And all renewable energy projects, including biofuels, qualify for an accelerated depreciation allowance of the ratio of 50-30-20 over a period of 3 years. Basically what it says, I mean, as we all know that the assets depreciate within your year one. I mean, you would have, once you start with your plant, you start writing off, I mean, like, as it depreciates. In year one, you will reduce that by 50%, year two by 30, and then year three by 20. So your tax as well goes down. Over the year, these incentives have proven not to be sufficient to lure investment in the biofuel sector, hence the need to establish more enabling and supportive regulatory framework. On the regulatory framework, maybe before I even get into the regulatory framework, I need to highlight the point that I would have been happy to see other departments here, because the biofuel sector is a multidisciplinary sector in terms of our respective mandates. But we will give progress in terms of what has happened and what are the issues that are still outstanding, as well as the challenges relating to the respective mandates. On the mandatory blending regulations, these were promulgated. We issued the draft regulations in September 2011 to solicit public comments until November 2011. And in 2012, February, there was a stakeholders workshop where the comments were consolidated and the final gazetting was in August 2012. And at the moment, DOE will firm up the date of coming into effect of the mandatory blending regulations after conclusion of the incentive scheme together with National Treasury. As I indicated, that this is a multidisciplinary approach in terms of respective mandates. Hence, you will see, even when we get to the position where we're talking about the cabinet decision, it will touch on various departments. Two, on the biofuels pricing framework, we initiated the pricing strategies. Basically, two technical studies were done, blending value as well as the break-even price, where at the moment it was completed in December 2011. For the pricing framework, as it continues, we also had a stakeholders workshop in March 2012 and convened a number of incentive discussions with Treasury as well as the DTI. And to this end, we have managed to finalize the subsidy principles, the draft pricing regulations and rules for administering the biofuels. An internal working document has already been developed. National Treasury is currently developing or at an advanced stage of the development of biofuel support mechanism. On the blending options and capital investment, this can be done in three ways. It's either you can blend at the refinery blending with the total capital investment of $2,278 million. And in this case, all the ethanol blending occurs at the 6 refineries in South Africa in order to minimize the investment in the industry. And the reason why it was done that way, minimizing the investment, was to make sure that because we are emerging in this sector, we don't let it, mushroom beyond what is required within the country. Hence, when you go through the mandatory regulations, it tells specifically that production has to be within the country, though the strategy also will at a later stage look at going into the SADC rating. But the point of that would be within the country. That's what basically the minimization of investment within the country refers to. It can also be done, at the depot. But the cost that was analyzed came to $459 million minimum. And in this case, all ethanol blending occur at the depot. Blending investment is limited to 2 large depots for each of the 7 oil companies in the country. And the third one, it can be a mix of refinery and depot blending with the total, the capital investment of $421 million. Following the indicated preferences of the oil companies, it is assumed that 2 companies will blend at refinery and the remainder will blend at depots, 2 each. We do bioethanol biodiesel comparison in terms of the incentive for the 15% rate, return on assets. We looked at the reference plant capacity, the estimated job creation per reference plant, as well as the estimated greenhouse gas emissions savings. for the bioethanol based on the sorghum production, with this incentive, you're looking at R1.95 per liter, whereas the biodiesel based on soybeans would be 253 cents per liter. And the reference plant capacity for bioethanol is 158 million liters, for biodiesel 113 million liters. The estimated job creation is along the whole value chain, not permanent. For the bioethanol, we're looking at 8,247, whereas biodiesel on soya beans production, 20,067. And on the estimated GHG emissions, you're looking at reducing by 30% on ethanol and then 50% on diesel based on the quantity. So this is where I'm saying I would have been happy if all departments are here that are contributing to the implementation of the biofuel, industrial strategy implementation. The biofuels task team was established in 2005 after a cabinet decision. We all have respective roles and responsibilities in relation to the success on the implementation of this strategy. There has been some ongoing discussion as well as research from Department of Science and Technology. We're hoping that before the end of financial year, they would be giving us the update on research findings and status quo on the second generation biofuels, as well as an argument or counter argument on the inclusion or continued exclusion of second generation biofuels. When it comes to the role of the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, they needed to support emerging farmers in negotiating contracts with biofuels manufacturers as well as financial assistance. And that's also dependent on once the financial support scheme has been finalized. We also looking at agriculture, to provide an argument or counter-argument on the inclusion or continued exclusion of maize and jatropha on the list of permitted feedstocks. You would agree with me that at some stage there was, during the development of the strategy, starting from the draft before the final one, there were concerns in relation to food security. Hence, the maize and jatropha were taken off the list. But recently, the discussion has continued in terms of what do you do with the surplus in terms of those crops. Do we need to include them? Or do we permanently say, for a while, let's hold on at South Africa, to get them off the list. At a later stage, we can include it. That falls within the responsibility of Department of Agriculture to steer the debate and come back to inform the decision that was taken there. So we're hoping to get a report from the Department of Agriculture before end of financial year. And we also looking at broadening the general public's knowledge as well as acceptance of biofuels. And this falls within the responsibility of all the departments that are contributing to the implementation of the strategy as well as the government communications and information system. And on this one, it's ongoing. It's not something that you will wait until you see a plan. That's when you start, sharing that information with the citizens at large. We need to now and then trigger the debate so that everybody being in an urban, semi-urban or rural area, they understand what the biofuels are all about and what would be the benefits for South Africa to invest. And also, the last point on the biofuels task team is to provide technical support to emerging and aspirant farmers. And this one is led by Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, as well as state-owned companies or state-owned entities, and it's been ongoing. When we received an invite from to come and present, there was an indication that we need to highlight the challenges that the sector is faced with hence you will see the slide talking about cabinet resolutions of October 2011. And each one of those would be talking directly to the respective challenges. I didn't capture it in terms of challenges, but I wanted to indicate to the committee that the challenges have already been elevated to cabinet so that we can move from where we were. In 2011 October, there was a cabinet memo to brief cabinet on the steps to be taken to implement the cabinet Lokota decision, Action 7, to unblock investments in the biofuels industry, of which at that point there was that acknowledgement that there are blockages and we need to elevate the matters for higher level interaction. And within that process, Cabinet noted the imminent publication of the mandatory blending regulations by the Department of Energy. And it also requested the urgent finalization of the financial incentive measures taking into account economic costs and benefits. Also agreed that the Minister of Trade and Industry reviews the previous list of approved allowable feedstock to include, amongst others, sugar and sorghum and the potential of importing such feedstock in the country. And I must highlight the point that most of the decisions that are taken, the implementation is still work in progress because some of them needed to be researched further before they can actually be implemented. And also, Cabinet agreed that explicit conditionalities be linked to subsidies and licensing, especially as it relates to the promotion of small-scale farming, job creation, amongst others. And Department of Water Affairs was requested to convene a meeting of Directors General of Department of Energy, Economic Development, Rural Development and Land Reform, Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, Science and Technology, Higher Education and Training, and Trade and Industry to develop a biofuel policy position for biofuel feedstock farmers. And the last one was for Department of Science and Technology to develop a national priority strategic research thrust to place South Africa at the forefront of second and third generation biofuel research. So most of these are still in progress or work in progress to sum it up. In conclusion, I would say a number of outstanding issues or deliverables are still work in progress to do the required technical investigation. Even though the 2013 target will be missed, the country is set to produce biofuels in excess of the originally set annual target when the overall enabling and supporting framework, mandatory blending regulations and pricing framework takes effect. You would note that the slide that I've shown in terms of the licensing process, it shows that we already having a capacity of above a billion. So that's what this point is referring to. And as much as the local biofuel industry is currently in its infancy stage, it does possess long-term potential growth. So basically that would be the update that I would give at this point. Thanks.
That was very brief. It is short. Honourable Member, thank you for asking me.
Yes, Chair. I think it's. I am of the opinion that we need to diversify our liquid industry, and that we need to minimise our risk, and that we need to look at all possible factors that that can contribute to improve the sector. This is just one of many possibilities that can be used, but also in the same breath, making sure that we try to create sustainable jobs. My question is, and it's going to be a little bit overlapping, is also to make sure that the cake in the fuel industry or in the liquid fuel industry, the amount of millions, billions of liters of fuel
being and diesel being petrol that we do distribute is only X amount. And when we do not provide business to be able to export that product or to store that product in order to export, we will not grow this industry, or we will grow this industry in the expense of another industry, and then we will not achieve the benefits that we would like to. So that's the first hurdle that you need to overcome, and you need to create those access markets in order to either go into the SADC countries or either to go wherever you need to go with this product. How are we going to transport this product in order to make it commercially viable is also that one I would like to understand from the department on how we're going to do this, on the subsidizing of possible transport, pipelines, typical storage, because these are major capital investments that we are talking about. And how is that arrangement going to take place? Is it in the planning phase? Where does it sit? The 2% possible blending of biofuels into the existing liquid fuel sector. If we look at that, if my calculations is right, we will probably look at 162 million liters at a year. Are we not going to create if I'm talking about the percentage that we're looking at, are we not looking at a possible creation of a monopoly of one or two major role players and sidelining up-and-coming or business that are trying to come into the sector? How do we sustain that? If we do up the market from 2% to 4 or 4.5% of possible percentages that were mentioned, is there adequate research on the table that talks to the quality of fuel that we need to provide? We have committed to a Euro 5 in a certain time frames, and what does that hold? And is the current refineries and the willingness of the current refineries to take up this challenge and to make this a viable sector? If we look at the present, if we look at the cane industry, the sugar cane industry, I know that there is a shortage of the part that goes where you take out the sugar and that becomes the alcohol portion, which we already importing that in order to make that into a viable thing. What are the you did a cost analysis on the 278 refinery towards blending and the depot blending of 450. You did those cost analysis. I would like to understand is because we're looking at a incentive scheme in order to build this industry, should we look at the tax incentives and not to have a 50% but like the 100% tax redemption on this product? What are the consequences to what we are looking for? You know, tax implications. What is it that we give? Because when we do give tax incentives, we've got to take from somewhere to pay somewhere. You know, and the IDC, the Industrial Development Corporation, late last year, when offered a 5.1 billion rand that they put aside towards this biofuels industry up to 2016, which allowed for 300 million liters of biofuels to be distributed. I would like to understand the context of this incentive. Is it for capital infrastructure? Is it for assisting possible refineries with blending material? Where does this, how does this fit into the DOE? They talk about creating 110,000 barrels, but 110,000 jobs just out of this investment. You were referring earlier just to 25,000. And when we are looking at 300 million liters of biofuels that are being then that should be produced, how does that affect the current market? You know, the 2%, the blending. Where's that actually going into? If there are limitations of the feedstock. And I need to understand that in the current situations with the refineries, in order to see that that we do sustain the other markets that is that are presently there. Jefferson, maybe I'll take another bite now. I just want to get my mind settled again. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions. One, we had an interaction with the department around biofuels, could be a year ago, and one of the outstanding issues that had to be resolved with the industry was around blending. Is it possible that you could refresh our memories why there were some divergence of opinion around this issue? What are the issues, and how were they resolved? The second one, I know it's not within your department. It's falling within the mandate of DWARF. There's this talk of a biofuels water policy. I'm asking a wrong person this question, but I would assume that we are privy to some of the discussion. Why would you want to draw a distinction between the conventional farmers who are and the biofuels? Is there any specific water usage that the biofuel industry would be exposed to? I don't know what are the discussions. I think that should be fine for now.
Thank you, Chair. I'm actually struggling to get all my thoughts together on biofuels because, you know, it's been a long time since we actually dealt with this issue. I remember in 2007, I think it was, when the strategy first came out, and we even did a study tour to Brazil to see how they had pushed up that industry and done it very successfully. But since then, there doesn't seem to have been a lot of movement. There doesn't seem to have been a lot of debate around this issue because it is a very complex issue, and we have to get all of the different variables right if we're going to make it successful. But I mean, I do find it strange that it's taken so long to actually get the blending requirements gazetted and actually put into law. So it is a bit strange that we came up with a big bang in 2007, but since then things seem to have gone quiet. But looking at this going forward, I mean, you talk about the investment that's needed of you can either do it refinery blending or depot blending. And you give figures of 278 million for refinery or 459 million for depot blending. Who is going to pay the cost of that? I think that is a kind of unknown question that's out there. Are we looking for refineries to put the capital investment in? And will the department be compensating them in any way for doing that? Or are we looking for them to cover that full cost and giving them some kind of incentive in the long term for having those refineries? And I'm wondering whether that will be, as my colleague said, as part of the kind of refinery upgrading scheme, which I know that we need to do in terms of meeting the cleaner fuel standard. So are we putting this as part of that program, and are we saying that the department will in some way compensate, or are we saying refineries must go ahead and do it themselves? I'm interested in that. The other issue is, if we really want to get the benefits out of biofuels as well, it's about getting to poorer rural communities and making sure that those communities can actually, in fact, supply the feedstock to the different refineries. The issue there, then, if I look at the ones that have been granted licenses, I mean, a lot of them are, say, in Port Elizabeth or in Craddock. There's not a lot that are, you know, in terms of the area that I deal with in the Eastern Cape, in the kind of former Transkei area, those kinds of areas, where I think a lot of the potential for small-scale production of biofuels is really evident. But what I found working with a lot of those communities is the transportation of getting their goods out of those communities to the market is particularly difficult. Are we looking at that in terms of the biofuel strategy, in terms of making sure that we can get feedstock from those particular communities and that we are creating a viable market for them? Because that is obviously our intended beneficiaries as well. So I'm just interested to hear what work has been done around that. Thank you.
Ma'am, Khad.
Okay, thanks. I will start with the questions as they were asked. The first question was, we need to look at possible factors to improve the sector, which I'll take it as a comment from Honorable Small, that the cake, I mean, in the liquid industry that we're distributing is only an X amount when we are not able to grow. The first one, it was more of a comment rather than a question. So you indicated that how are we going to transport or store the biofuels in the planning phase. So you wanted, I mean, DOE to respond on that. In terms of, like, the mandatory regulations, they do touch on, I mean, the issues of transportation as well as the storage. The second question was the 2% target fuel that we need. Are we not creating monopoly in the sector? I need to answer it in this way. The strategy gives provision for review before 2013. And, like, based on the challenges that we have already experienced, the strategy has not yet been reviewed. It's only now that we're intending to start with the process. And in terms of the monopoly aspect to the question, I think the outcome of how the first phase went would dictate how the review process needs to take into account the issues that you highlighting in terms of the monopoly point. You also asked on if we were to improve the 2% to 4%, are we undertaking adequate research on the quality of fuel that we need on this? Within the mandatory regulations, the blending, the quality issues are taken into consideration, and that is also part of the licensing requirements. So the quality part is covered within the licensing processes as well. And on the 2% versus the 4%, I need to highlight the point that initially when the drafting started, the estimation was at 4.5%. But based on the conditions on the ground, it was too ambitious, and indeed the results at the moment, they show that it was extremely ambitious because we haven't even met the 2% that is in the current strategy. So that's how I can answer it. And you also linked the 4% or the 2% target to the willingness of the refineries to make to contribute to the sector. During the public consultation or the consultation with stakeholders, the refineries, the whole value chain, they are very ready, to contribute to the sector. I must say, though there were, concerns raised there and there, but we managed to find each other in terms of dealing with those within the mandatory regulations. I can confirm the sector is very much ready to start even tomorrow, but we need, the financial support scheme in place. Hence, I said National Treasury is at an advanced stage of finalizing that. It's a fact you see even with the Renewable Energy IPP program, the financial aspect took longer than we anticipated, but if it were to go the way we wanted it, we would have started earlier. There was a question on cost-benefit analysis. Should we look at the tax incentive? And then you indicated that IGC has put 5.1 billion rands aside to support the sector. At the moment, I wouldn't be in a better position than National Treasury to indicate the kind of, the financial support scheme, which has not been released officially. Hence, even when I presented, I indicated that I would have been happy if all the departments which are held, responsible as per our respective mandates are here to deliberate on these issues. So I would request that a follow-up report back. We have all the departments so that all the deliverables are deliberated at that level, because I'm not mandated to speak on behalf of National Treasury and it falls within their mandate. There was a question on, the 2% target that you asked on, you also further indicate or ask the question on where does it go if we have limitations on the feedstock. In terms of the strategy requirements, it requires the Department of Agriculture supports both, the small farmers in terms of production. Should it be that we have limitations, that would be the point where it dictates that now we can even go beyond, the borders of South Africa to get more feedstock. I would request that you repeat the question in terms of the 110,000 jobs by IGC based on this investment versus the 25,000 jobs.
The argument, the statement made by the ID by the Department of Trade and Industry with this 5.1 billion rand, that's a incentive that has been put up until the year 2016 that says that should this be an uptake or provided to this industry, and there's an uptake of this, 110,000 jobs would be then created. In your presentation, you referred to the 25,000 jobs created, and I would presume it was to do with the 1 billion litres of this that would be then produced. And therefore, I would have thought because there's a multidiscipline issue at hand here between the various departments, that I was just trying to correlate the two figures. Maybe it's something else that it's not been taken up on board. I'm just trying to understand, because if it's two different things, it tells me it's 125,000 jobs that is coming up. And this is just my understanding around this.
Okay, on that one, I need to indicate that the 25,000, jobs was an estimation then when the strategy was drafted. But in terms of, the 110,000 jobs is also linked to the new growth path estimation in terms of how each sector would be contributing. So, and a lot of things have changed. At the time when we were still talking about the strategy, not even having had implemented, so many things were not in place. And now, based on the current circumstances, it warrants us to review in terms of the actual jobs that would be created. So based on, international studies, where similar projects have been implemented, it linked to the 110,000 jobs. That's how IGC also arrived at the current figure. Honorable Mloto asked the question on just clarity or more information in terms of the concerns or outstanding issues around the blending matter between industry and us, and how was it resolved. I must indicate that, as you are aware, when we're talking about, I mean, investments, there are capital, I mean, like high capital costs that are also part of the process, and the market always wants certainty in terms of what would happen, so that when they put, I mean, the investment, they are fully aware that the risks are addressed. So through the mandatory regulation process, the stakeholder workshops, that's where most of the things were resolved, hence the regulations were promulgated. The second one was on water license. Why do we want to draw distinction on the conventional versus the small farmers? We all aware that South Africa is a water scarce country, and there are stringent conditions when it comes to water licensing. And like the concern has always been, biofuels would also add, I mean, to or will impact negatively on the stress, the water stress that the country is already going on. But the research has already shown that in terms of, I mean, the crops that we're looking at, there would be no serious impact. Hence, from the Department of Water Affairs side, there was an indication that, I mean, according to the agricultural sector, 60% of the water already allocated goes to irrigation, and the current proposal needs to find itself within the 60% already allocated on the irrigation part. Honorable Kreilen talked about, I mean, asked the question in terms of who will be covering the cost on blending and capital investment. And I must say, this doesn't make difference to the IPP program. We also expecting private sector to come to the party. And the incentive that we're talking about from government, we need to meet one another halfway. And like they are expected to play their part, government as well need to enable the environment. Hence, without the incentive, it would be difficult for the market to take off the ground. So National Treasury is hard at work in terms of making sure that the support scheme is in place, and like the indication is we might have that even before the end of financial year. So that's the latest discussion that we have had with them. And then you indicated, you touched on, if we want to get the full benefit in rural communities to make sure that the sector is successful, what the things that you do, we're doing. You also touched on transportation, I mean, in relation to the sector. The strategy is very clear that we need to focus, I mean, mainly in the former homelands or the previously disadvantaged areas. And, like, the location of the plant doesn't necessarily take away that requirement in the strategy. It's still the main point in making sure that the former homelands are the key areas where we would focus on as versus commercial sectors. I'm not sure whether I covered all the questions. If there are any follow-ups on the ones that I've touched.
Can I maybe just add to some of the questions? There was a question around the Euro 5 standards and how biofuels are integrated into those standards. We can assure this committee that indeed they're being incorporated. And in fact, the biofuels will also help us to achieve those clean fuels two standards. Then the other thing, Chairperson, is on the, just to add on the blending issue, some of the issues we had with the industry in the beginning, Honorable Mloto, is that at first the industry gave us a figure that was an industry figure in terms of the blending cost. And as a department, we said, no, we need a breakdown per company to know at your refinery as company A, what will be the cost to actually, you know, upgrade your refinery to be able, I mean, either your refinery to be able to take biofuels and so on. So that's where some of the issues were. Hence, we then had to commission a study to do what is known as, you know, blending value. that we can share with the committee, you know, the outcome of that particular study. But it was now a breakdown per refinery, as to say, at refinery X, what would be the cost of bringing 2% of the biofuel. The last one, in as far as transportation of the feedstock to where it's required, I think it was difficult to actually determine the cost of that, because we don't know if this will be going to the depot or will be going to the refinery and so on. But once these plants are established and up and running, we'll then be able to determine, because in the fuel pricing structure, you know, we deal with the transportation of the fuel or the feedstock and so on. That will be able to work out once we know where these plants are and how much the plant is producing and the distance where the feedstock is moving from and so on. That we can be able to finalize in a short period of time, Chairperson.
Yes, Jay. I want to understand that when we look at the strategy that is up for review, and when we also look at the implications of what blend or the percentage of the blend should be or should not be, I don't think my concern is this: should we make it a mandatory concern? And looking at our circumstances within the context of South Africa, maybe being a drought-stricken area, and this market for some reason or another cannot produce the 2% coming up, for whatever the reason is, what then? My solution to this is that you allow the industry or the refinery to uptake the product or this biofuels, the sector, allowing for incentive uptake. So should the refinery take up 2% or 4%, depending on what is available at that context of that market, within the conditions of the license requirement, within the conditions of the quality that needs to be provided, you then in a 2 or a 3 year period then can determine what the market really can produce, and you can start bringing statistics to the ground depending on the product of on how you produce this the various of these products, either cane, maize, or whatever you're looking at in order to produce this product, and that's where the incentive scheme should be lying, and that's what we've got to do, and it's for the and it's then for the department then to make sure that the product that the South Africans are using is then meets the standards that we would like that to be used, and we've got to play it maybe differently, and there should be a type of an uptake. It's similar to clean green energies uptake, where we do other issues. My concern is that you say that I do understand the various role the IPPs comes to the market with government with the various incentives, but this is a long-term investment. This is big capital investment, and it's very difficult for business to go into huge capital programs or expenditure if there's still some sort of uncertainty, and policy must be very clear to say where these incentives are, where the tax rebates are beforehand, and I would hope that at some point that we do get some time to maybe debate a little bit more, or we allow this committee to involve in some of these incentive schemes before it helps, because it does not help to put an incentive scheme out there that is not really going to benefit the market, or that's not really going to be really cost effective, and those things, or that we are I hope that you understand what I'm trying to say in that context. The other area, it's good that we do look at making sure that biofuels do grow in the areas of poverty-stricken areas, but the further you go from where the actual infrastructure or the or some of the capacities already is, the more expensive it becomes. And when we do that, the incentives then must speak to that in order to address that, and we've got to look at those things. And it's no use just to give when you put the incentives out, when you outline the incentive scheme, it's got to cover these sectors. And because we haven't have access to it, I can only speculate to what if or what not. And Chair, I would hope that you will ask the departments or some of the departments that that will come and speak to this committee a little bit more to give a bit more clarity or to some of the questions that we have in this. But thank you for a very interesting discussion point today, and I'm sure it's not the last one as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. You know, and I ask these questions knowing that you're probably not the right department to answer them, but I think it does speak to the biofuels. There was, for instance, problems initially with the Cradock biofuels manufacturing facility, which the IDC was supporting. Has that facility now actually been built, or what is the sense of progress on that? Is that up and running, and can we start to see some biofuels coming from that? Because that was supposed to be the flagship project coming from there. But they also said there was the IDC wanted to build 5 biofuel manufacturing facilities, but they seem to have then changed that to say, no, they're just going to stick with Cradock initially. So I'm just interested to see where that particular debate is going at the moment. Because I do think it is, I mean, if your focus is on the former homeland areas, you know, the fact that what I see here is 2 in Port Elizabeth, 1 in Cradock, there's nothing else. And I can tell you, having worked in some of those communities with farming products, is that the biggest issue is trying to get your product to market. And if you're going to have it so far away, you're not going to get the intended objectives around there. So I do think rural development, the Department of Rural Development really needs to look at this particular issue. You can't simply think that this is going to happen by itself. We have to look at how we design this project properly so that we get the kind of benefits. Otherwise, it might just be a big subsidy scheme for commercial farmers. And we need to really delve into some of the details around the agricultural plan to make sure that we get those intended benefits. So perhaps we need to call the Department of Rural Development to see how far advanced they are in terms of making sure that happens. But I'll be interested in your comments on that now. Thanks.
My question is similar to that of Honorable Khaled. It's around the Cradock project, because it was reported sometime last year in one of the weekly newspapers that it was experiencing problems. But when I look at the footnote on page 6 of your presentation, it talks about that it has been granted a conditional manufacturing license because the applicant has not met all the requirements. I just want to understand what are the outstanding requirements that still have to be met by this project, and what were the problems that it experienced earlier.
Take the question.
Fine.
Okay. Justin. Okay, let me just start with your, Honorable Mulato's question in terms of the actual requirements. Due to confidentiality issues relating to the application license, I'm unable to disclose exactly what the requirements are. But generally, I mean, there are various requirements like EIA, I mean, land availability, like a whole lot of factors that the licensing process is looking at before a license is granted. But at the moment, there are outstanding requirements that they have to meet. Hence, it's granted, it's not issued. And yes, I do agree with Honorable Freling in terms of bringing rural development on board. They are part of the BDG. Hence, I even said it would have been better if all the departments are here so that they can give the actual role or the deliverable status in terms of firm commitment, because I'm a little bit confined to speak on their behalf. And in relation to the questions from Honorable Smal, yes, I believe the committee would have an opportunity to engage with the support scheme from National Treasury. As I indicated, that I mean it's at a very advanced stage. There would be that opportunity to unpack it in depth in terms of, I mean, what is it all about and how would it benefit the sector or the country at large. The intention was, I mean, the plan from National Treasury is to finalize that before the end of financial year. We're not talking about a long period because this is something that is long overdue, and the pressure as well in terms of getting started with all the issues of biofuels. And you did indicate that maybe we need to rethink the approach as to whether this need to be a mandatory matter or we need to allow the refineries or the sector, I mean, to go beyond. The strategy, I mean, does make a provision in terms of once you are aware of the difficulties, particularly when it comes to production or feedstock production, then you come back with Plan B. At the moment, it's very difficult because we haven't started in terms of confirming whether the country has difficulties in those, I mean, identified areas where the feedstock has to come from. But once we start, that would be an ongoing analysis because we shouldn't wait until there is a problem. We need to have some kind of triggers that tell us that, I mean, in a year or two we'll have a problem. Then we start putting the enabling environment in place. Hence, I say the good part is, I mean, the strategy does give that provision to include even the SADC region in terms of the feedstock process. Because one of the things is, for example, within the food crops, where there is surplus, where it can either be considered. Those are the discussions that we're still having, I mean, even with agriculture, in terms of making sure that the discussion around maize and jatropha, are we saying, are they off the list forever or should they now be considered? Because at the time when the strategy was developed, the country was still in dire need on issues of food security. Hence, it was taken off on the basis of the experiences even on what was happening in Mexico at that particular time. So now maybe is the appropriate time to engage on those because the status is no longer the same. Yes.
But then what if it comes back?
Chair, you're saying if it comes back?
Yeah, the very challenge you're talking about.
Remember, I indicated that, I mean, before we can even go to a stage where there is a problem of not having feedstock at all, once we start, we need to be, I mean, monitoring firmly so that we have the trigger to say there is this problem which would, I mean, give us that firm consideration of putting the enabling environment in place to engage even the SADC region in terms of the feedstock.
Chair Mayor, Chair, this is my concern. Should any of the products used in making biofuels, and I'm not talking about just maize or whatever, should any thing happened due to the acts that is beyond the control of this country that limits the product, that limits the production of that product. If we've got a mandatory issue to say that the blending is 2%, whatever that percentage is, and the companies that are presently are here or are in this field cannot cope or cannot take that, you cannot produce it. It's going to force the refineries then to import that product. That's how I understand it. So we've got to go and source or import that product to make it. What I'm saying is, because we're not sure, and you said it yourself, the uncertainty of this market to either produce the crops or to make sure, we're not sure where it is and where it lies. So what I was suggesting is that you allow for the market to determine the need in order to have that uptake. The uptake of that market might be 2%, might be 3, might be 4.5, or whatever that uptake is, but you allow for the market to develop itself within that context, and then with the information that you are that is available to the department, always being regulated at a point or to a point by the department, then allows to come up with a fixed, let me call it for a better word, fixed mandate to say, these are the regulations, this is what it is going to be, because now you've got, the market has given yourself a position to go for. And this is where your review of your strategy comes into place, and this is what I was hoping that the department will be, because this the whole start up of this sector should be in the beginning phase, should be a bit flexible, and we should allow for flexibility in as long as it is controlled in the license agreement and in the regulations. I cannot want to argue less or less. It's a comment that I'm making. You don't have to respond to it. But what I wanted to say, Chair, I'm sure that we need to make sure that this sector, as well as the other sectors in the liquid refineries business, in the electric petroleum business, always is cost effective, that we don't shed jobs, but we rather than create the jobs. And it's that flexibility that I'm asking for. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, comment taken. We will take that into the review process. There was a question from from Honorable Freiling, but the plans for...
Guys, are you becoming comrades this year?
My apologies.
We know that 2014 is the exciting year, not 2013.
My apologies for that. Whether the plans for CREDOC are still in place, I just need to confirm the plans are still in place and at a very advanced stage. So, not yet.
Done. Thanks very much for that, Mem Khadi. But my first salvo is that surely we need to do a follow-up on this. No, not because of the departments we're talking about, but even the way you were grappling with this. I mean, the question I have is that what reference documents are we dealing with right now? Are we dealing with the 2007 document? There's nothing latest up to now. Everything is under review. Probably that's fine, but. To me, it triggers a couple of questions which I'm not going to ask. You see, one of the things one would like to exactly know is how do we locate biofuels within the liquid fuels industry? The clean energy drive. One of the members have been raising quite a couple of pertinent things. The market penetration of biofuels.
issues around blending, issues around biofuels and water, the refinery situation, how would biofuels fit in there, the incentives. I agree that it is quite appropriate that we raise those things. What we've done our best to respond to them, but surely it is going to be even more helpful that we have some finality on this. I suppose when we arrange a follow-up, one of the things you'll help us on is actually to give you a roadmap towards a finally reviewed policy position, program, including all these issues that I've highlighted, even others as well, such that we are quite clear about where we're going to, you know. There's the issue of the security of feedstock as well. There could be a few other things we're handling. But we cannot run away also from the dilemma and the emerging debate vis-a-vis maize and jatropha. Because, as I said a few days ago, I picked up an article whereby the issue of debate of security of food and security of feedstocks for biofuels, which one is the priority? I definitely must say that it's good that we put the issue of biofuels back into our agenda as the Portfolio Committee for Energy. However, on the other hand, it is clear that it's an unfinished chapter. You've taken note what members have raised, and surely you factor them one way or another. And we'll be preparing ourselves as well. We'll look at our program and see where we can fit in a follow-up. But definitely would welcome advice from the department as well as who else should we be inviting. Probably not only the department, you know, but also agencies which you feel are appropriate. Probably. What if we invite IDC? Because, I mean, I know also from my DTI or trade and industry experience that IDC was quite involved in this area. There could be others as well, but the key player, so that we are meaningfully, you know, engaged in the area of biofuels. I think, Honorable Herling, it's been helpful that you made mention of the committee's visit to Brazil. I would request, you know, the committee secretary to retrieve that report and just share it with us. Quite a number of us were not there. We know how advanced Brazil is in bioethanol, so it could be helpful, you know, just to refresh our memories and get more empowered, you know, as to how Brazil is handling this area. Obviously, not just the report, but also their policies as well. That's where the interest is, you know. Yes, we are remolding the strategy, but what's the policy that's driving and informing that strategy? But hopefully, this has been a good step in the right direction, so that as we move along, we ensure that all different energy sources, including biofuels, are addressed appropriately. As for now, let me thank the department. Let me thank honorable members for their valuable inputs here. also in the meeting. Tomorrow we are going to continue with the public hearings on energy efficiency. Remember, we did have the first round last year, but we realized that there was more institutions which did not either turn up or which is covered were also quite appropriate to come and share with us their experiences, to update us on what they are doing, make recommendations, and so forth. Just a good reference would be the National Foundry Technology Network. That's just a network we picked up along the way. We all know how foundries are guzzlers of energy. So it would be good to hear from them as to what strategies and programs do they have, regarding energy efficiency and the rest of them. But obviously, let's prepare for us for that. And by the way, honourable members, particularly Public Works. Last time Public Works did not make it, and Committee Secretary, make sure Public Works is there. We cannot go around asking people to be energy efficient, and as part of the state, we do not ensure that. And the lead institution is the Public Works, because it has the competence of handling all government property. So we would like to hear from them the extent and the manner in which they are ensuring that the state leads by example to ensure that there's energy efficiency in all our buildings, whether design, management, or whatever. The same with SALGA, to share with us, as to the extent to which municipalities are doing the same. We've had a couple of municipalities individually sharing with us, but now we want to have a global picture now as to what's happening there. I don't remember, but the pity others are not around. I trust and hope we'll hold hands together in this area, because the extent to which we have impact on ensuring energy efficiency in the country will work quite positively and have a tremendous impact on the overall utilization of energy in the country, including savings, obviously. But for now, let's keep that for tomorrow. And can we bring the meeting to the end? Thank you very much for coming. The meeting stands adjourned until we meet tomorrow at V454, 9 o'clock, the other side. Thank you.